We will go ahead and get started then. Good morning and welcome to the Delta Stewardship Council meeting. It is 9:34 on Thursday, September 26, 2024. We are here at the Hilton Stockton, located at 2323 Grand Canal Boulevard in Stockton, California. My name is Julie Lee, and I am the chair of the Delta Stewardship Council. Today's meeting is a teleconference meeting pursuant to Government Code Section 11123.2 of the Bagley-Keene Open Meeting Act. Councilmember Hueso was planning to participate in person, and unfortunately he was not able to join us in person today. However, Government Code Section 11123.2, subsection J2, allows a member attending remotely to count towards the in-person quorum if the member has a need related to a physical or mental disability that is not otherwise reasonably accommodated pursuant to the Federal Americans with Disability Act of 1990, provided that the member notifies the council at the earliest opportunity possible of their need to participate remotely and provides a general description of the circumstances relating to their need to participate remotely. The council must take action to approve this exception. Yesterday, Councilmember Hueso provided the required notice of his need to participate remotely, including a brief description of the circumstances. For Councilmember Hueso to be counted towards the quorum today, the council must take action to approve the exception. Is there a motion to allow Councilmember Hueso to participate remotely and be counted toward a quorum at today's meeting?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
All right. Motion by Councilmember Burgess, second by Councilmember Zingali, and we will proceed with a roll call vote. Emma?
Councilmember Burgess.
Yes.
Councilmember Demrell. Councilmember Hueso.
Aye.
Councilmember Maranian.
Yes, here.
Vice Chair Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Zingali.
Aye.
Chair Lee.
Aye. The motion passes. Unanimously, congratulations, Councilmember Hueso. You're allowed to participate as an in-person member. Thank you, and hope you're feeling better. Next, Emma is going to explain to us how the public can participate in this meeting. Emma?
If any member of the public is interested in providing public comment on any agenda item during today's meeting, please send an email blue card to engage at deltacouncil.ca.gov. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item you wish to speak on. When called, the clerk will unmute you.
Thank you. In accordance with the Bagley-Keene requirements, we're going to do a roll call vote of all the in-person council members. This will include Councilmember Hueso pursuant to the vote we just took to establish a quorum. Emma, can you lead us in a roll call vote for the in-person council members?
Councilmember Burgess.
Here.
Councilmember Demrell. Councilmember Hueso.
Here.
Councilmember Maranian.
Here.
Chair Lee.
Here. For our remote council members, please disclose if there are other individuals over the age of 18 with you and a brief description of their relationship to you. Additionally, please remain on camera for the duration of this meeting if possible. Emma, can you lead us in a roll call vote of the remote council members?
Vice Chair Miller.
Here, and I have one person in the room with me that's over 18 helping me make sure that I'm online. Thank you.
Councilmember Zingali.
I'm here.
Are there any individuals over 18 with you in the room?
No, there's no one else present in the room.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have a quorum. The next item is our public comment item. This is for anyone in the public to comment on any topic that is not on the council's agenda today. Any comments on items on the agenda will need to be taken during that item. Emma, do we have any public comments for items not on today's agenda?
No, Madam Chair, we do not.
Right. Our next agenda item is our tribal environmental justice issue paper public review draft release. We are going to have our council staff present the public review draft of the tribal and environmental justice issue paper and facilitate a discussion with our community partners. So I'd like to welcome Amanda Bowl, our special assistant to planning and science with the Delta Stewardship Council, and she's going to invite the rest of, or introduce the rest of her colleagues.
Great. Thank you, Chair Lee, and good morning, council members. I am Amanda Bowl, special assistant for planning and science here at the council. And I think I speak for everyone here at this table when I say how excited we are to be presenting the public review draft of the Tribal and Environmental Justice Issue paper to you and to the public. This paper is the culmination of 3 years of work by many current and former council, staff members, and fellows, and represents staff's evolving understanding of tribal and environmental justice in the Delta and our recommendations on how the agency can better conduct its work through these lenses. The overall purpose of today's presentation is to preview the key components of the draft paper, helping to prepare you and the public for your review and comments. We'll provide a brief overview of the process staff undertook to develop the paper, walk through the key components, and outline the next steps for finalizing the paper. So our plan for this morning is first to have you all hear from all of us. And following our presentation, we welcome questions and comments from the council. We'll then invite members of the organizations that participated in the EJ Expert Group to the table to reflect on the process and the contents of the paper. And then this will be followed with time for the council to engage with our expert group members as well. And then there will be time for public comment. So co-presenting with me today are Environmental Program Manager Morgan Chow, Environmental Scientist Megan Thompson, Environmental Scientist Annie Merritt, and Senior Environmental Scientist Annika Ragsdale. Next slide, please. So as you may recall, the council's 5-year review identified environmental justice as a key emerging issue, and I should specify the 2019 5-year review, identified environmental justice as a key emerging issue, noting a specific need for more information and analysis to inform potential future actions. With all of this in mind, 3 objectives for the issue paper were set, which you can see on the screen in front of you on the screen and in the presentation you have. The geographic scope of this paper is what is considered the legal Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and staff recognizes that tribes and tribal communities view the legal delta as an artificial construct. So as such, this paper is not a full exploration of all tribal and EJ issues in the Delta watershed and how tribal and EJ issues manifest both upstream and downstream of the Delta, which, however, we do feel is a topic deserving rigorous study but was beyond the scope of this particular issue paper. Furthermore, when staff began this initiative, we identified a need to delineate between environmental justice as a whole and environmental justice issues as they relate to tribes and tribal communities, which we refer to as tribal justice in this paper, and we'll go into a little bit more further in the presentation. Next slide, please. So to understand tribal and environmental justice, the paper follows the conceptual framework before you in this graphic. This graphic summarizes the 3 interrelated tenets of representation, process, and distribution used in the paper to build a holistic understanding of environmental justices and injustices in the Delta. And we'll be referencing this framework later in the presentation when we present current issues and recommendations. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned at the beginning, this has been a 3-year effort, and it has incorporated several modalities of research, which are represented on this slide. Rather than go through each of these, which are also documented in the staff report, I'm going to hand it over to Morgan, who's going to dive a little bit deeper into the process staff undertook to engage with environmental justice groups and to create the EJ expert group. Morgan, and next slide, please.
Thanks, Amanda, and good morning, Chair Lee and council members. I'm Morgan Chow. I'm the program manager for our Climate Change and Environmental Justice Unit. And I'm just going to walk through, as Amanda mentioned, the process that we underwent to solicit input for this paper. First, we as staff define community-based organizations, or CBOs, as nonprofit organizations that organize, advocate for, and or provide services to specific populations and communities that are disproportionately impacted by Delta management. Additionally, there are a lot of differing definitions of what it means to be an EJ community. We started with the state's definition of disadvantaged communities that notes disproportionate impacts of pollution and other hazards and demographics such as income and unemployment. And our interviews and research over the years have really helped us further define and address the nuances of what determines an EJ community, and we have recommendations related to how we improve and define these groups in our paper. So the two main components of community input here are in dark blue. And the first is the creation of our EJ expert group, as Amanda referenced. And the goal here is really to develop closer relationships with CBOs throughout the Delta. We reached out to more than 60 organizations and more than 100 tribes with diverse expertise and geographical coverage. We held a kickoff call with approximately 20 participants. And four organizations expressed interest and became our expert group that you'll hear from today. The second is our interviews. We conducted more than 20 semi-structured interviews with organizations, with CBOs, to really legitimize and prioritize voices of communities that have been disenfranchised, marginalized, and disproportionately harmed by environmental burdens. We used the same outreach list for our interviews as we did for the expert group and applied purposive sampling, so we made sure to get a variety of expertise and geographic focus. And then from the interviewees' recommendations, we then applied a snowball sampling method to reach more groups. And as we approach having a public draft, our expert group members and several tribes have had the opportunity to review the draft of the paper prior to its release, and we've been spending a concerted effort to connect and hear from EJ communities throughout the Delta. Throughout this year, we've attended more than 15 community events, reaching more than 200 people, and six of which were just this last month. Next slide. Tribal engagement has been a critical component of this work from the beginning, and I'll touch on some of those components here. When we kicked off the project, Brandon Chapin, our tribal liaison, reached out to our listserv, as I mentioned, for the expert group. And as a result, we have representation in our expert group from the California Indian Environmental Alliance, which serves tribes across the state, who you'll hear from today. We also interviewed three tribal serving organizations. Most importantly, notices were sent for pre-consultation before writing the paper to all tribes with cultural affiliation to the Delta for consultation, and we met with four tribes. And I'll note that our past chair, Virginia Madueño, attended one of these consultations. The council also held, as you know, its first ever listening session in April 2023, where this photo was taken from, and input from that listening session informed the paper as well. We've done our best to attend as invited to tribal community events such as Native American Day, which is tomorrow, and Honored Elders Day, and others. Lastly, we're planning a 90-day consultation period where we'll meet with tribes as requested for consultation, and we plan to hold a hybrid tribal roundtable on October 15th. And I'll hand it now to Megan to introduce our paper content and some parts of our history.
Thank you, Morgan. Hello, Chair Lee and council members. My name's Megan Thompson with the Planning Division. For the next several slides, next slide, please. For the next several slides, we're going to present key components of the issue paper, providing the primary takeaways. We won't go over each section of the paper as seen here in the table of contents, but rather touch on the highlights. Next slide, please. To help us understand the context in which we're attempting to address tribal and environmental justice in the Delta, staff felt it was important to include a robust history section. Key to this is acknowledging tribal history. The Delta ecosystem at one time supported more than 10,000, or 3% of the estimated native population in California, who view the entire watershed as one interconnected, culturally sacred system. The Delta landscape, however, has been radically transformed from an indigenous managed marshland to industrial, agricultural, and freshwater conveyance system by settlers and government, which set into motion many injustices that shape the region. These interdependent social, ecological, economic, and engineering developments have included the Swamplands Act, which incentivized large-scale reclamation for agriculture. This meant draining the wetlands and converting it to ag. Levee building, which enabled the conversion to agriculture to protect from flooding risks, is another one. Today, there are 1,100 miles of levees, which have resulted in a patchwork of islands, channelized waterways, and land subsidence. Redlining, the practice which was led by the Federal Housing Authority in the 1930s, and assessed the metropolitan areas according to their desirability based on race and other factors. They assigned color codes, red being the lowest. which guided financial interests and mortgage approvals. This has left lasting patterns of segregation, systematic discrimination of these redlined neighborhoods, and disproportionate exposure to environmental harms that persist today. Lastly, water infrastructure facilitated further displacement of Native Americans, and although tribes have been resilient through this devastation caused by Euro-American settlers, there have been long-lasting implications. I'm now going to pass it over to Annie to talk about Section 5, current issues.
Thank you, Megan, and next slide, please. So, yeah, good morning, council members and members of the public. I'm Annie Merritt, an environmental scientist in the council's planning division. So, yeah, I'm just going to give a high-level overview of some of the key issues discussed in the draft paper, and this is in Section 5 of the paper. So input from the different sources that informed this paper led us to identify procedural, representational, and distributive justice issues. And if you recall from a few slides ago, those are those three tenets of environmental justice that Amanda mentioned. So issues related to procedural justice, for example, included concerns that government agencies are often only trying to check a box when they do outreach, people often being unfamiliar with issues or how to engage in government processes, inaccessible meeting times and locations, and limited resources and funding. So all of these, we heard, are barriers to meaningful involvement in Delta governance. For representational justice, some important examples include the need to better understand which communities are most impacted by environmental harms, and really creating a place at the table for tribal and environmental justice communities to be able to fully participate in Delta governance. So these are just a few examples, and these are discussed in depth in the paper. So for distributive justice, we identify and discuss seven key overall issue areas. So these include water, flooding, climate change, pollution and public health, housing and homelessness, food security and access, and recreation and outdoor access. So I'm going to start by presenting a summary of the tribal justice issues, and then I'll cover those key distributive issue areas. And also just want to note that all of these issues are deeply interrelated. So next slide, please. Okay, so because tribes and tribal communities have their own unique experiences, I'll be addressing all three of those tenets as they relate to tribal justice. For a little more context, today there are over 109 federally recognized tribes in the state, as well as numerous non-federally recognized tribes, and many Native American people, both within and outside the current legal Delta, who have ancestral ties to the Delta watershed. Many tribes actively consult with local, state, and federal government agencies to exercise and advance their priorities, and to seek recognition and redress for the environmental injustices enacted against them over time. So really, as we say in the paper, tribal justice is the advancement of equity for tribal nations, Native communities, and indigenous communities, with the understanding that tribal sovereign rights, traditions, and cultures have been and are being affected by environmental hazards and other impacts. So we talk about a variety of tribal justice issues in the paper. So at a high level, these include representational injustices, for example, rooted in often the lack of recognition of tribal priorities by federal and state government agencies and developers. We also see representational injustices in often the non-recognition of traditional knowledges, such as indigenous land management practices, languages, and ceremonies. Some procedural justice issues related to often the disregard or disrespect of tribal representatives and the marginalization of their expertise, as well as often the exclusion of specific groups such as non-federally recognized tribes from agency engagement processes. And then finally, a few distributive justice issues face tribal and indigenous communities specifically. So for example, tribes and indigenous communities might have unique exposure pathways from water contamination. For example, if they use water for ceremony or eat fish harvested from contaminated waters. Next slide, please. So yeah, now I'll talk about those other key distributive justice issue areas. So first, water. So we talk about water justice issues a lot in the paper, but at a high level, those include concerns related to water supply and management, including concerns about injustices with the water rights system, conveyance of Delta water, water quality issues, including the proliferation of harmful algal blooms, and water affordability. So just as one example of drinking water insecurities seen in the Delta today, you can see on the map here that as of April 2024, 11 drinking water systems in the Delta are failing human right to water standards, and 27 are at risk of failing those standards. For flooding, a few key issues that came up included concerns about the allocation of levy investments, flood insurance access and affordability, and land use planning. And finally, for climate change, just as one example, some Delta communities are disproportionately vulnerable to climate change-related hazards, including flooding, extreme heat, other hazards. So for example, Stockton and much of the rest of San Joaquin County, we found are most vulnerable to increasing flood risks with climate change. Next slide, please. So on to pollution exposure, public health, and recreation and outdoor access. So yeah, Megan defined redlining earlier. So redlining practices, as well as other past and current land use decisions, have really led to those communities facing a disproportionate exposure to pollution today and resulting long-term health impacts. And also, research has shown that historically redlined areas, including in the Delta, today experience a greater vulnerability to a variety of other environmental hazards like flooding and extreme heat compared to non-redlined areas. For recreation and outdoor access, there's also currently just unequal access to recreational areas and open and green space across the Delta, and this has resulting impacts to human well-being. And next slide. Okay, so to wrap up this section, another very important set of interrelated issues relates to the rising cost of housing and cost of living across the region. So the Delta Residents Survey in 2023 showed us that about one quarter of Delta residents have a household income of $50,000 annually or lower, and say that the affordability of basic needs like housing or food are a key challenge to their well-being in the region. We're also seeing a related issue, rising number of unhoused populations across the region and a lack of adequate sanitation resources for the unhoused. And really, this is a violation of human rights and human dignity. And finally, also closely related are issues of food security and access. So as one example, four of the Delta's counties have a higher rate of food insecurity than the state average. So yeah, that was an overview of the key issues. And now I'll hand it over to Morgan Chow, who will start giving an overview of the recommendations.
Thanks, Annie. And yes, now we're very excited to come to the recommendations, which is new. You haven't heard about these yet in a council meeting. So these can be found in section 2 of the paper. You just heard a very diverse set of issues that came up through this process from Annie, some of which are beyond the council's authority to address. And part of our role as an agency and in writing this paper is to document all of the tribal and environmental justice issues that communities and tribes are grappling with in the Delta. And then our we have recommendations that focus on what we really can tackle as an agency. Our recommendations do, however, both include general recommendations, which we'll cover first, that are relevant to all agencies working in the Delta, and then a more in-depth list of recommendations that are specific to the council. And we'll touch on examples of those over this the next several slides. Next slide. So first, here's our general recommendation list at a high level. it's first starts with investing in relationship and trust building with the communities that you want to serve. So really working to demonstrate agency commitment, working through trusted community partners, tailoring outreach to meet unique needs of the community that you're working with. Being intentional and justice-oriented. So this is about recognizing that communities that have been left out of planning and policy conversations for generations, that building trust may take a while. Making it easy to participate in the agency's process. Follow through, super important. Being transparent about how feedback will be used and then following up on how it was incorporated. working to enhance connections across agencies, so recognizing agencies can be more coordinated to reduce community fatigue. And then lastly, identifying and working to fill research needs to help with decision-making, so including topics of emerging concern from communities like harmful algal blooms and other community-identified science needs. Next slide. So now to our council-specific recommendations. We have them organized according to four goals. Goal one is really about integrating environmental justice across everything we do at the Delta Stewardship Council, starting with memorializing our commitments to environmental justice through a future resolution when we do have a final plan, and taking several actions to create a more inclusive workspace. As we mentioned up front, we note really that there's a need to improve our spatial understanding of Delta and statewide, really EJ communities that are affected by Delta and statewide management. So this is an example here of our screenshot of our social vulnerability index that we created several years ago as part of our climate adaptation work. And this has been a great baseline for understanding of community vulnerability, but it has its own limitations and really can be built on from what we've learned through this work and other efforts. And the lastly, this goal addresses ways to improve both tribal and environmental justice community representation in Delta governance, and works towards developing new partnership models for tribes, community groups, and government. Next slide. Goal two really focuses on tribes. So some examples of supporting actions that are included here are engaging in partner agency efforts around tribal access and use of the Delta, so including co-management, land return, protection of tribal data, and things like that. Continuing to provide cultural humility trainings to council members and staff, as Brandon has been leading. Continuing to explore interweaving of traditional knowledge with the Delta Science Enterprise. Continue to improve consultation efforts, engaging early and often. Considering regularly evaluating our tribal consultation policy. And with that, I'll pass it to Annika to cover the last two goals.
Thanks, Morgan, and thank you, Chair Lee and council members, for the opportunity to present today. I'm Annika Ragsdale. I'm a senior environmental scientist in the new Climate Change and Environmental Justice Unit, and I'm excited to share our last couple recommendations. You can go to the next slide, please. So this goal, goal three, is about furthering community-engaged research that centers on community needs and desires. For example, at the council, we can include tribes and EJ practitioners in the council's Delta Social Science Community of Practice, and into our Science for Communities program, which pairs community organizations with scientists to collaborate on projects together, which I know some of our EJ expert group members have also been a part of. And we can safeguard tribal data ownership by developing a council data management protocol to make sure that any information shared by tribes and communities is handled responsibly. Another important component of this goal is to improve the communication and distribution of science in the Delta through effective outreach and transparency. We can make council-sponsored research and data publicly available when it isn't held in trust from a tribe or a community partner, and use the council's communication resources to share information about climate change risk directly with Delta communities, which we've been doing this summer and will continue this fall through our different outreach events we're doing in the Delta, like pop-ups and presentations. And next slide, please, and I'll share the last goal. So the final goal is focused on addressing funding inequities in the Delta and in our own science funding process. We can support equitable investments in Delta communities through guiding funding to tribes and environmental justice communities wherever possible. And we can explore, creating a climate justice technical assistance program to help Delta communities prepare for and adapt to climate change. And we can support Delta-specific legislative appropriations that are targeted towards environmental justice in tribal communities. And finally, to make our own science funding process more equitable, we can evaluate opportunities to dedicate Delta science funding for tribal and environmental justice research and develop proposal evaluation criteria for environmental justice communities to help those applicants and reviewers consider how environmental justice issues can actually be integrated into research projects from the start. So with that, those are our recommendations, and I'll hand it off to Amanda to talk about next steps.
Great. Thanks, Annika. So what's next? The draft paper is currently out for a 60-day public review period, which will end on November 4th, as well as a tribal consultation period, which ends in early December. As previously mentioned, on October 15th, we'll be hosting an in-person and virtual tribal roundtable. And then during the public comment period, staff will also conduct additional community outreach. This fall, we plan to join events in Stockton, Sacramento, Walnut Grove, Lodi, and West Sacramento to continue to connect with Delta community members. Community concerns and ideas that we hear during this outreach will be considered along with other public comment as we finalize the paper. We have also translated the executive summary and the info sheets into Spanish, and those are available on our website. And then in terms of when you all will see it again, we plan to bring a final back to the council early next year for endorsement after we've reviewed and incorporated the public comment and comments from the council members. So now, staff, we're all here and available to answer any questions that council members have and to hear comments. And then following your questions, we'll invite members of the EJ expert group to the table and to our screens to hear from them.
Excellent. Thank you, Amanda, for that presentation, and thanks to your team as well. I see Councilmember Zingali has his hand up, so I'm going to let him dive right in.
Thank you, Julie. So first, I just want to say directly to you all, Amanda, Morgan, Annie, Megan, Annika, Brandon, anyone else who worked on this, I've seen a lot of good attempts in this area. I have never seen an EJ paper of this quality from any state agency. I just think it's the work, the time, and the commitment that you all and others put into this really shows. It's one of the most thorough and unflinching and compelling papers I've seen in this area, and I've looked closely at many over the years. So I really want to congratulate you on that. And I want to be somewhat specific. I think that in the area of establishing principles, the paper particularly really shines through the general recommendations and just statement of principles in the beginning and throughout. I think those could be useful across state government. I think the process is another remarkable aspect of this. Just you've walked us through the process, and it shows that there's been very active and genuine listening that's contributed to this. And I just really commend that. I think there are some good specifics in here. I think if I had to try to find an area where I would like to see more, it would be in kind of down in the weeds. So for me, when I look at the three objectives, the third objective, identify options. For that, I really hope to see very specific policy recommendations. And maybe there's a reason why we shouldn't go quite that far in the weeds, and you guys can tell me that. But so, for example, just when I see an objective like goal 4, that we should support funding appropriations, can you tell us what specific appropriations we should support? And it's kind of the same for me throughout some of the goals where I feel like I just want a little bit more. The principle is clear and right on, but I would like for us and the world to see specifically what actions we could take. So that would be the one area I'd like to hear a little bit more from y'all on now or in the future. But congratulations. This is the highest of priorities for me in serving on this council, and y'all have done a remarkable job. Commendable. Thank you.
Yep, Maria, go ahead.
Yeah. Yes, this is very thorough, and I know that it's the product of a long period of time that we all worked. I have two questions. One on the slide that reads water flood. On the slide that is titled Water, Flood Risk, and Climate, where we talk about the flood risk, is there a model or a percentage from the flood risk, how much of it impacts the tribal communities and how much is generally EJ? Is there that proportionate analysis anywhere?
To my knowledge, there is not that proportional analysis currently available.
You have a sense for it? Like,
I'm not sure if we even have a sense for
30%, 20%.
I don't even want to guess because I wouldn't want to
so
you
no
know, get
analysis
it wrong, so.
Was done in that sense. Just no. Because, you know, to follow up the question of funding and all mm-hmm. that, it will be important that if there is allocations for EJ, how do you proportionally then, you know, allocate mm-hmm. it to tribal versus non-tribal generally EJ?
Absolutely.
So I think it's something that it's worth looking into later on.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second question is where we talk about food security, housing, and unhoused, that is, again, generally EJ, correct? There also there isn't a proportionate distribution of what percent tribal. Because if we are really focusing on the tribal, it's important to have that because we're generally saying EJ. We always said EJ, but we didn't say tribal. And now... Mm-hmm. It's important to make that distinction for future steps.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's something we could probably dive into a little bit more for the next iteration to see if there really is more information out there available.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's all.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
You know, it's historically, folks from vulnerable communities were excluded intentionally. You know, it was to their advantage, those that were doing it, to exclude them, to not give them information. And so what we're doing right now is trying to develop something that evens the playing field, even though the playing field is uneven. And as I've spent time with folks from some of these different communities that are represented, what I see is a similar experience, you know, that I've had when I've come into a new situation. I'm trying to figure out who I'm sitting at the table with, you know, what their values are, what they need. I'm trying to figure out who the smart people are, who's giving me the right information. I'm figuring out what I feel about it, what I think about it, what would work for us, how to fix something that's been broken or to prevent something from breaking in the future. And so I think that's what we're doing right now. And I think what I have seen is that these communities often are still figuring out who's sitting at the table. They're still figuring out, as it relates to them as a tribe or as a community or, you know, whatever, is what's important and how things are impacting them. And so I think this is a really... I've got to say, the leadership that has made this a priority, I am really appreciative and I want to acknowledge. I want to also acknowledge the staff because my observation is that each of you that's working on this has taken this on as something that's important and that is meaningful. And so I just want to say that I love the energy and the intelligence and the expertise that's going into this. And I think that by analyzing this and putting it in words and presentations, we are helping folks understand why it's important. And I think that the organizations on the ground are the ones that can help put it in the words and in the presentation so that people can understand why it's important and why they need to get involved. So I think this is a really great scaffold for us to move forward. I am concerned that this could become a box that people checks. And so going into the goals, I really like the goals. The council members and Gali talked about specifics for things that could be for funding and all of that. And that changes from week to week to month to year to decade moving on. And so what I would recommend is that if it's not the Delta Stewardship Council, it's something within the state government that does a research that says these are the resources available right now or for this year or whatever. And so that creates some sort of informational source that would allow organizations, communities, advocates to know where that money is coming from. And I think one of the funding inequities is access to experts, because experts cost money, not because they want to get rich, but because, you know, it's a job and it's a research and it's all of those things. And so I really hope that there will be some leaning in on giving people access to expertise unbiased, so that it's not coming from the folks that already have their finger on the scales, but someone that can come in and give them, you know, whether it's the research or the help in legal advice or the negotiating or the communications, all of those things. That's what I have observed. And so I'm really glad that this is coming out. I know that it's not perfect, but I think it's a really good start, and I appreciate all that contributed to it. Thank you.
Is there any legislative effort that you know of or aware of that would address this issue?
Well, I think the state is making different efforts. I know a lot of community groups are working with their legislators to address various aspects of the various issues that we address in the paper. I don't think I have like a current running list of what those would be, but I know this is certainly environmental justice issues, and you know, the administration is working a lot with tribes, and so I know that things are being done, but to what extent, you know, I don't have a list currently right now to say what those would be, but there are various attempts, I think, currently underway.
Oh,
and I'm going to refer to our legislative and policy director, who will be able to give a clear example.
Councilmember Dammer, I'll just mention too, I have a few bills I'm going to go over in our ledge report later that I can point to. There's various, like Amanda said, there's various different ways that the legislature and groups are working through that process to address those. And I can walk through those during the ledge update if that's helpful.
Well, it just strikes me that this would be an ideal effort on the part of the legislature, and I don't know who is the person that would be leading this in charge, but it would seem to me a natural for somebody that would mold this issue into something very meaningful. And I, you know, it strikes me as a very important issue that is apparently is not addressed in any shape or form. Is that correct?
I think that's part of our goal here, is to move the conversation forward to better inform not only legislative efforts but other state agencies in the way that they operate in the Delta. I do think there are some bright spots where there is progress, but I think Councilmember Burgess is right that this is part of our job here, is helping to educate others about what we're learning from our partners and on these issues, and to elevate that so that the conversation can advance.
And hasn't the governor kind of taken a leadership role in kind of elevating this? And isn't there someone in his administration that actually kind of leads a lot of these? Am I right?
Certainly on the tribal side.
Yeah.
Yes.
Councilmember Hueso, and then Councilmember Miller after that.
From that subject, I don't know to what extent, other than making the document public, that we send copies of this to the legislative offices, to both the Assembly and the Senate. I think this would be excellent information. They're always looking for data. They're always looking for information on which to base legislation. So studies that the state publishes often are sent to legislators. If we can do that, I think it would be a great way, without making specific recommendations, just send the document so that the legislators and their staff can review. I think that would be very beneficial to the whole process.
Yeah, and I'll add really quick, one part of the outreach for the issue paper to public draft is to have a briefing scheduled with legislative staff to walk through the recommendations and the draft report. Is that exactly what you're mentioning, Senator Hueso?
Councilmember Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two really brief comments to build on what everyone else has said. One, in addition to the compliments from Daniel, I'd like to compliment the humility with which you approached this work. It's phenomenal that you really listened, and I agree. I haven't seen a paper like this that has that actually really defers to groups that came to you. So I appreciate that, because I think it's important that we approach it really kind of with this beginner's mind, because there is absolutely a lot we don't know. And in that same vein, the way you outlined the objectives just to the previous conversation, this is obviously a very long-term project and lots of work to be done, but I think that there are some very significant actionable goals and objectives that we could really build into a longer-term strategic plan for the Delta Stewardship Council. And so what you've really done is create the beginning of some longer-term objectives that the board can really work towards and take a keener interest in learning about. So I think those two things mean that this is not a study that will sit on a shelf. This is really a call to action, and it's incredibly well done. So it's that and a call to learn. So I think it'll be hopefully, and I think have almost no doubt that it will be incorporated into all of our work and all of our strategy going forward. So really grateful and really look forward to continuing myself to learn and to the action items that we can continue to take.
Thank you. I want to give plenty of time to our stakeholder groups, but I also want to make a couple of comments to the staff. I also think it's a fantastic report. I realize, as Councilmember Burgess pointed out, we are still in our process of actually writing it, and it is a process. I know that it spanned at least three chairs, if not more, since it was first in the five-year plan. So I'm, particularly happy that we're getting the public draft out while I get to be sitting here, because back in 2019, when Governor Newsom came on board, we had been dealing with the Me Too movement and diversity, equity, and inclusion issues in the state, kind of at an individual level within each department, and there hadn't really been a coordinated effort coming from the top down, and Governor Newsom had us create a training for all department directors, agency secretaries, everyone in the very top executive offices on implicit bias, and we brought in Dr. Brian Marks from Morehouse College, and we did an all-day training with all of our executives about diversity, equity, and inclusion. As Gail well knows, our state budget is huge, and it's really difficult to tackle a topic like this without getting into the departments and having the departments really see what internally they each need to do in their programs. So that was sort of the gist of that training, was we realize that we have a lot of implicit unconscious bias. Our focus in that training was a little bit towards hiring and our administrative policies that we were trying to address to make sure that we were all current on our sexual harassment training and ethics training and all the other things that we do, but also to sort of bring in this new training component about bias. And what it really brought to light was the fact that if we do have unconscious and implicit bias happening, as we know we do, we can acknowledge that, how is it actually affecting our programs? And so if you have a grant program or you have a contract program, how is implicit bias potentially affecting the people that can benefit from those programs? And that really was sort of the whole direction at the beginning of a lot of the efforts of diversity, equity, and inclusion back then. And so I'm so thrilled now to be in this position where I'm seeing some of the results of that initial work, because COVID, I think, really put a different spin on things for the state for a few years. And even though I hate to say that these things got put on the back burner, I think that, it's a testament to the amount of passion that you guys have for this work and for the stakeholders that have been involved in our process that, you know, coming back around, even though it may have taken a little longer than we might have wanted, we have this incredible document that is really focused on what we can do and what our recommendations are going to be. So I just, you know, kind of wanted to mention that. I haven't seen other reports like that from the state at this point. I think people are we're still working on these things in departments. I don't know if you guys have any information about other reports that we might have modeled this after, but I feel like we are kind of at the cutting edge of it. So we're inventing something, and we always say, don't invent the wheel with the state, find something someone else has done. But I think here in this case, there will be a lot of other departments, and we know that there's been interest in this. I think we can acknowledge, you know, how much stakeholder interest we've had, not just from our partners, but from not just from our EJ and tribal partners, but from other state agencies that, you know, have had a real interest in what we're doing here. So I'm very proud of that, and you know, glad that we are making the progress that we're making now, and that we have a light at the end of the tunnel on the draft report.
Yeah, thanks for that. I do want to acknowledge that we're not the first state agency to explore these issues, and we greatly benefited from a few other agencies who had very helpful reports and approaches and lent their expertise as well as we began this journey, particularly with the Ocean Protection Commission was instrumental, and Amanda might be aware of a few others that we relied upon.
Yeah, the number of agencies, even the Water Board has done some work like this, and a number of other entities. And certainly as we were scoping this project several years ago, and this predated me being involved, a lot of research went into looking at what other agencies had done, both in the state and federally, as guidance, because, to the degree we didn't want to recreate the wheel unless we needed to, and there were a lot of helpful examples out there.
Great.
So with that, I would like to invite the members of our EJ expert group to the table and to our screens. And I think just while this transition is happening, I really want to, and I'll do a more proper introduction in just a moment, but I'd really like to thank the folks in particular who are speaking today, Sherry, Gloria, Bob, and Barbara, for their time this morning, as well as their time and thoughtfulness over the last few years. I also really want to thank Sarah Medina from Restore the Delta, who's in the audience, Matt Holmes, formerly with Little Manila Rising, and then also Jasmine Peterson from Little Manila Rising, who also were helpful and participated in the EJ expert group over the years as well. And I do want to reiterate, too, that staff, or this has been mentioned by some of you, staff has learned a lot from everyone who has been involved with this, and we have a lot more to learn. This is the beginning of a process, and it truly has been a humbling experience, I think, for each and every one of us who have been involved in this. So I really do have a heartfelt thank you to everyone's involvement in this. So anyway, enough of us. So speaking with us today, and in this order, we have Sherry Norris, Executive Director with the California Indian Environmental Alliance, who is joining us online. Gloria Alonso, Environmental Justice Advocacy Coordinator with Little Manila Rising. Bob Erlenbush, Homeless Advocate with the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness, also online. And then Barbara Berrigan-Perilla, Executive Director of Restore the Delta. So, and I'll hand it over to Sherry to begin.
Hi, can you hear me, everyone?
Yes, we can.
Okay, hello, good morning. I want to first thank Morgan and her team for their coordination and facilitation of the EJ expert group, of which I was a member. And I wanted to touch on one thing that the councilwoman asked about climate change and if there's any, what percentage would be impactful to tribes or EJ communities. And that is a really good question. It's actually similar to a question I asked related to the and the land that's being returned to tribes. And the thought is that would this land be sound during the climate transition? So my recommendation is that we share maps with the latest modeling and distribute that to tribes and communities so that they can evaluate that. Because at this point, we've had it's kind of a moving target, what the saltwater intrusion will look like, you know, how sea level rise will impact. That's a really good question, and I would love to explore that more. my comments today are, and my piece is related to process, and then a few recommendations that didn't make it in. And related to process and the draft now being shared publicly, unfortunately, Sia's contract or my contract to be part of the EJ expert group ended before the final draft was completed and available for public review by the group, or review by the group before it went publicly. I did ask if I could review that final draft one more time, but we're told that since we were not in contract that we could not. But since I'm listed as part of the team, it's disappointing that this draft doesn't fully reflect what my recommendations would have been now that I've read it. It would have been able to clear up some missing information, some errors, and some omission where there's and or in areas where key points in the language was changed that results in some of these areas that I wanted to emphasize being de-emphasized inadvertently. In keeping with tenets of EJ, we recommend that in the future, when groups are convened to provide content to a document, group is afforded the opportunity to review the final draft before it goes out to public, even if reimbursement for their time is not possible. For many, including myself, it's the quality of the work that's most important over the ability to get paid for that work. And I recognize that that is not the case for everyone. I'm not saying that that's a good basic tenet is to ask people to do work without being compensated. That's not the case. But in this case, this document is really important to me and really important to tribal communities. And I really want to make sure that the final version that they're reviewing includes as much as possible. So with that, I have a couple things that I wanted to tell you that I can see in here that could use some support and edits. And I'm not sure if that can happen before the October 15th tribal meeting, but at least perhaps these can be included in the conversations at that time with tribes. In particular, I hadn't seen the executive summary. And the executive summary explains that tribes are political entities, but it doesn't talk about that tribal members have a multi-citizenship status. And I think it's really important for people to understand that when you talk to tribal members, you're talking to people that are citizens of counties, states, and the states that they reside in, additionally, are citizens of tribal nations, and the tribal nations have responsibility to their membership. So that really plays in with EJ communities, because we do hear, sadly, from some of our colleagues in the EJ world that they don't understand why tribes are asking for treatment that they might view as being preferential. And it's not that. It's that is that tribal nations are governments and do have that self-determinant and that responsibility to their own membership. So I think just elevating that response that tribes have responsibility to their membership is really important in that context setting document. On page 6, we talk about there's a chart there, and I could see a few things that could make that stronger. Under representation, it says impacted communities are represented in the decision-making process. It would be really nice if it wasn't just in the decision-making process, but it was also in the outcomes of those processes and having them, the opinions of tribes being incorporated into the decisions and not just being heard, right? And I do see that throughout the document, but I think to have it elevated, because some people aren't going to dig in and read the whole thing, to have that in this graphic would be really good. Similarly, distribution, we talk about making sure that not one community bears the disproportionate burden. I would really like to see that negative impacts are avoided. EJ communities and all communities really would prefer not to have the negative impacts in the first place. So if it's possible to include avoiding them, it'd be wonderful. Then I also wanted to highlight free and prior informed consent. It was part of one of the interviews later on, but I think that earlier in the text, that the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, those are really EJ principles. And so to include those in the document higher up would be extremely important, and we would do well to do that. Principle of EJ, it's imperative to understand that traditional knowledge or traditional ecological knowledge is to be applied by the designated individuals of the tribe from which that knowledge originated, or with permission by and in partnership with that tribe. And that's really key to be stated really early in the document. And then also, we don't have a definition for traditional knowledge or TEK and it could be included there. Unfortunately, some of our some people that view themselves as allies to tribes think that their inclusion of traditional ethnological knowledge in their work because they read something or they heard something, that that's enough. But traditional knowledge and tribal ecological knowledge is something that is adaptive. So often it's adaptive in the field. You have the tribal expert look at what's happened, changed, and changed the treatment that they're recommending. Also, they may need to go back and speak to a body of experts in order to come back and apply that community expertise into the project. So I'd like to see that elevated. Then there's a few other things in recognition and the recommendations that we have. That one that's enhanced connections between state agencies, local governments. I would also like to include tribes, because tribes are governments, right? That would be really good if we could include that. And then we move into council-specific recommendations under Goal 2, expanding opportunities for tribes to practice their cultures. I would also say subsistence and cultures, because those the eating of the foods and the practicing of culture are need to be called out specifically. Strategy 2A, build and strengthen relationships between tribes. I would include the word partnerships whenever we're talking about those relationships, because actively working together and not just talking with each other. Talking is important. It's one of the first steps, right, to building partnerships. But I think that partnerships is important to include. And then whenever we discuss tribal consultation, we need to make sure that we are clear about meaningful tribal consultation. Unfortunately, consultation is still being misunderstood, that it's not a matter of describing, and we should include explicitly in the document, that it's not a matter of meeting and telling a tribe what's going to happen. It's a matter of meeting, coming to the table, and having the decisions not already be set in stone, so that tribes can provide real information about whether a project should or should not move forward, or how that project can be augmented. Often lately, we are seeing a lot of projects, a lot of consultation that wherein the agency is coming to the table with the decision already made. And that's not in the spirit of consultation. That's just informational. So we need to be, it'd be nice to include that kind of a sentiment in the document. And then in 3B, incorporate tribal knowledge and partnership with originating tribes of sound science. And I have a few others like this, so I will skip ahead. It's just really important that we move into in the tribal justice section, that we reiterate that same piece on free and prior informed consent that would be in the executive portion, and that we talk about in climate change is an urgent need for it to be understood that traditional knowledge created, maintained, and could restore the diverse ecosystems and resources found in California. What's needed is an understanding that traditional knowledge is that primary source of information, and that it be considered as best available science based on thousands of years of observation and application. And that's down below, but I think it could be elevated in the document. The area on displacement of original habitats, the population is low. I leave this to my other colleagues to discuss as well, but that does not meet what the text has shown. It's at least half as low as what I've read and seen in other areas. There's an importance to talk about how tribal members and tribes that have been moved from their traditional territories in the Delta, they still maintain those connections, even in the face of barriers, and that they're not just in, it says that they're in the Sierra Nevadas, in the eastern portion of the Sierra Nevadas, that they're also scattered in other rancherias around the state. We failed to include mercury and the mercury loading in the Delta system. I have a whole paragraph on that needs to be included. So I think that's something that we can work on together. There's a whole piece on how tribal members, as a lot of SIA's early work and why we do the work that we do now, is that one of our early jobs was to tell tribal members and about how to avoid eating fish that are high in mercury. And we saw some very solid and hard visuals of tribal members experiencing grief and the worry that their children would then experience permanent learning disabilities. So when we talk about impacts in the Delta to environmental degradation. This we really want to make sure that mercury is included. It's continuing. It doesn't look like it's. We don't have a plan for moving it from in stream. We do know that some of the Delta contribute to methylation, so that's where we're wetting and drying areas that for farmland, and where we are creating dams that then result in decaying plant matter, which jumpstarts the methylation process. So, lastly, that we want to make sure that we include in there that anytime an organization like myself, like our organization, the California Indian Environmental Alliance, is engaged, that does not mean that the tribes have been engaged. So I look forward to the process now for public review, and hopefully we can have some dialogue with tribes to edit this document collaboratively so that we can have agreement on some of the pieces up here, especially since we're in the final version and there might be some differing perspectives, and I hope to be a part of that conversation. And that's all that I have today. I want to thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Sherry. And I will hand it over to Gloria Alonso from Little Manila Rising.
Good morning, Chair and members of the Council. I just want to begin by extending my gratitude to the DSC and every staff member that contributed to the production of the issue paper. This is an effort that predates me, actually. And in that note, I also want to acknowledge, even though Morgan already mentioned, the contributions from my colleagues, Jasmine Pedersen and Matt Holmes, over the past 3 years. I'll keep my comments short. But I also want to acknowledge that as a young professional and a representative of Little Manila Rising, this is an important issue for me because it focuses on how we as a community provide and contribute to these first proactive steps towards understanding the complexity of issues across the legal Delta and beyond because of the legal Delta. It's only a human-drawn boundary that doesn't encompass other impacts across California and other ecosystems. It is important for me to elevate that as a first step and as an agency, these are root causes here across the issue paper that elevate the inequities embedded in multiple levels of California water management, not just in relation to the Delta Stewardship Council, and most importantly, it raises an important question about how the issue paper will become a tool for advocacy for years to come, right? And because it is really, it is a real observation from, as an advocate and as a young professional, to see papers like this just be put in the drawer and never be used again, or never in particular be used to empower communities and the communities that are addressed in the paper. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how it can become a tool for such efforts. The Delta and its diverse ecosystems and communities face multiple threats today, and I'm sure that the majority of the audience is aware of the projects that will perpetuate the extraction of natural resources in the Delta. I am proud to say that I have benefited from the leadership of Restorative Delta in fighting these threats across multiple generations, and it's sad to see that generations will depart this world without seeing success, and now this is like incumbent on us to continue the fight. And so just to reiterate, these are areas and communities that go beyond the human-drawn legal boundaries, and by default, they go beyond this issue paper, right? Because the issue paper just focuses on such. And so to finalize, the DSC is uniquely positioned to accomplish all of the recommendations voiced by Morgan earlier and even more with specificity and intentionality. And I'm eager to see the progress on those and to continue contributing to building a stronger voice for environmental justice and the Delta Stewardship Council. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gloria. And now I'm going to hand it over to Bob Erlenbusch, who's joining us online. And then Bob also has a few slides, so if you could move to slide, I think, 25. And one more slide. Thank you. Bob?
Good morning. Thank you again for the invitation and for allowing me to be on the environmental justice working group for the last couple of years. Again, I'm Bob Rollenbush with the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness. We're an advocacy coalition locally in Sacramento County. I'm also on the board, longtime board member of the National Coalition for the Homeless in Washington, D.C. Homelessness obviously is not only a housing justice issue, and in many cases a civil rights issue, given the continued, from my perspective, criminalization of people experiencing homelessness, but clearly an crosses over as an environmental justice issue as well. To frame the issue, we have about 200,000 people experiencing homelessness in California, roughly 8,000 to 10,000 in Sacramento County, and best estimate by the Sacramento Park Rangers is about 1,500 or so people experiencing homelessness along the American River Parkway. To put it into the context of today's topic in particular, as it relates to tribal justice, disproportionately people in California, including Sacramento, but also San Diego, San Francisco, et cetera, are disproportionately African-American and indigenous. African-American homeless people are overrepresented by a factor of 4 compared to the general population of about 13%. So roughly 40% are African-American. And Native Americans, indigenous people experiencing homelessness are 6 times higher than the population in the general population, which is about 1.5%. So roughly 10% of the homeless population are indigenous. In Sacramento, that means, well, you can do the math pretty easily. In Sacramento, that means roughly 1,000 people, and in California, roughly 20,000 people. Next slide. So climate change, sort of stating the obvious, highly impacts the health of people who are highly vulnerable. People experiencing homelessness. To remind you that in California, California has the highest percent of unhoused homeless people due to no fault of their own, due primarily to the lack of shelter and the lack of obviously affordable housing. So highly vulnerable to all the different aspects of climate change, which is a matter of life and death. Just last year, we had 8 homeless people in Sacramento die during the storms. So rainfall, increasing temperatures, wildfires. Just a second on wildfires, and fire and smoke, especially for people who are outside. Increasing research shows a direct correlation. It's called fire brain. If you look it up, fire brain, direct correlation between wildfires, exposure to fire and smoke, and increasing mental health issue. For about roughly 40% of people experiencing homelessness have other mental health issues. So being outside, being exposed to extreme heat, fire and smoke makes those mental health issues even worse. So exposure to floods and droughts and violent storms, extreme heat. Don't forget, if with 70% of the homeless population outside, if it's 108 air temperature, it's about 130 on the grass and even hot, maybe even 140 degrees on the pavement. So that's important to remember. It's not the air temperature, it's the temperature you're exposed to by being outside. Also in terms of the under impacts, lung disease and allergies, the single biggest health issue for homeless people in Sacramento and for many homeless people around the country is asthma. So being exposed to fire and smoke and extreme heat, et cetera, is really makes lung disease and allergies the number one health issue, public health issue, for physical health issue for people experiencing homelessness. So to sort of cut to the chase, we need warming centers, we need cooling centers, and we need clean air centers, of which two, they are far and few between, not only in Sacramento, but in communities up and down the state. We do not have enough warming centers, cooling centers, or anything close to a clean air center for people who are exposed to dangerous air quality. Next slide. Study done by the Berkeley Law Center a couple of years ago, environmental water justice for all, is that as has been mentioned, there is in California the human right to water and sanitation that is really not been acted on. Despite California passage of AB 685, there are really no minimum water standards for access to water and sanitation, really no way to enforce the mechanism to incentivize jurisdictions to comply for AB 685 as it relates to people experiencing homelessness. And it also makes it worse as an environmental justice issue. It's an environmental nightmare. The lack of water and toilets is worse than required by international law. Next slide. So you can just sort of see the connections between the human right to water and sanitation, environmental health, public health, and environmental justice. We did do, as that sort of yellow circle, we did do the coalition of, about 5 years ago, looked at every single of the 205 city parks in Sacramento. Only 16% or 33 of them had bathrooms that were open. 21% were locked, and 63% only remained open from sunrise to sunset. And you can see the different parts of town: Arden Arcade, Fruit Ridge, the Central City, North Natomas, and South Sacramento. The lack of access on the part, specifically the city, to public restrooms. And it's gotten worse. Next slide. So just to conclude, the city has done it, and the county have done a terrible job of providing access to sanitation. At the height of COVID, I think there was about 50 porta potties that were put out by the county. Most of those have been taken back. So homeless people literally have nowhere to use a restroom except for the streets and alleys of Sacramento. Finally, I mentioned the continued criminalization of people experiencing homelessness. What that means is that people's stuff is taken all the time, not only their personal possessions, but their life-sustaining possessions. In other words, when there are police sweeps, not only by the sheriffs, but the LAPD, et cetera, people's tents are taken and destroyed, their blankets, their sleeping bags, et cetera. So not only did I say that homelessness is a housing justice issue, an environmental justice issue, but in the case of police sweeps, a civil rights issue as well. So we would like to see specific to the issue of water and sanitation, really an enforcement of a law that already exists that it doesn't have any teeth to it, or if it does have teeth, it's not being used as it relates to people experiencing homelessness, the human right to water and sanitation. Again, thank you for the invitation.
Great. Thank you, Bob. And now I will hand it over to Barbara. And Barbara also has a slide, so if you want to move it to slide 30, to the next one. Thanks.
Good morning. Barbara Berrigan-Puria, Restore the Delta. You know, first, I really want to extend a special thanks to Dylan Chappell, who came out and joined Restore the Delta this past weekend for our coastal cleanup on Mormon Slough, which is at the heart of the environmental justice community in the urban Delta. I also want to acknowledge just the years of work from Morgan, Megan, Annie, Brandon, Dylan. Well, recently, we've worked with Annika and with Amanda. The work that they've done, and I think you've picked up on it, has been that this project has been a real labor of love for them. And they truly love the estuary, and they truly care about the people. And so we are very grateful for their collegiality, their partnership, and their attention to detail. Overall, and one last issue I also wanted to bring up when we're talking about how to look at the report in terms of proportion of tribal populations. One of the pieces, and I think Sherry was getting to this, but she kind of cut out a little bit, is that we have to remember that the Delta was home to numerous tribes, and while I do not represent tribes, I am part of the Delta Tribal Environmental Coalition. Vice Chair Tayaba from Shingle Springs always refers to the Delta as the supermarket for tribes historically. There are dozens of federally recognized and non-recognized tribes who consider the Delta their historical homeland. They still return there and use the Delta for spiritual, cultural, and sustenance practices. So you can't just proportionately say X amount of tribal people are impacted when they were forced through relocation from genocide and were displaced from the estuary. It's still their homeland. And that's kind of the way you have to look at it. You can't break it down to a percentage issue. That also brings out something that we had put through as an edit in a report, and I couldn't tell when we couldn't hear Sherry if she had referenced this. I hope I'm not being redundant. And that is that there was a specific number put on the tribal population in years of existence in the Delta, and our tribal colleagues, when I hear them speak, would not address it that way. So when you have your event on the 15th, they would refer to their relationship to the Delta as being part of time immemorial. And I know if you were to ask them about the thousands of people who are tied to the estuary, that they would have difficulty with the numbers that were included in the report. I bring that up because what happened at the end, after many years of good work in terms of representational justice, didn't actually completely play out in practice for the conclusion. And I think that's where some of these small errors are coming up that we're questioning in the report. But I also think, now that you've heard Bob, and you've heard Sherry, and you've heard Gloria, you all did what you're supposed to do as a government agency. You listened to us. You wrote a terrific report that summarized ideas, that put numbers on it, and made boxes, and put goals and policies. That's what government does. When you listen to us, we talk about things differently, and with very specific language to move the ideas of equity, inclusion, tribal justice, and environmental justice forward. So we have a little bit of a gap with the report. You have this great report that's written, and you own the report, in government ease. And what you just heard from Bob, what you heard earlier from Sherry, those are the details that come from the expertise of the people you collaborated with. I wish some of that could get picked up and be placed still in appendices. Because that's the detail on the ground, that is the tribal ecological knowledge, that is the depth of understanding of community that puts the color and puts the on-the-ground meaning in the kind of higher-level policy that is put in a government report. With that said, we are happy that this report happened. It is the first, in many ways, we think of its kind, particularly around Delta issues. We went through a challenge, in part because of the state budget, but we had turned in our paperwork to for our next contract to finish the report. The paperwork was held up in bureaucracy for several months, and then we found out after the fact that we were not finishing the report. I completely agree with Sherry and really want to stress that when you collaborate with somebody on something for years, yes, we advocate for funding for environmental justice groups to be at the table, to build equity, and for our tribal partners. But this work for us is really centered in love of community and love of the place. And we really wanted the chance to be able to finish the work and finish the final recommendations. So we get the draft, and we don't see that level of specificity that I'm kind of talking needs to go into in appendices or even in the recommendations. And that's then where it feels unequal in representational justice for us and how it was implemented. I also think it was a calamity of errors, in all fairness. You know, part of this is tied to what's happening presently with the budget. We get it. But I would say be prepared. If you're going to work with people and you're going to incorporate their work, make sure you see it through to the end. Don't forget them in the process. And here's, I think, the last kind of piece that, you know, and the reason why I put the quote up that we did, because there is a recommendation and there are questions through the report about should we be looking at environmental justice issues out of the Delta. I want to stress that nobody has ever really done a specific report on the Delta watersheds for tribes in the Delta before. And that's why it had to happen this way and in this order, because the government has to acknowledge and look at what are the conditions that are causing disparate impacts on a region that is a majority disadvantaged region and a majority region of people of color. When you go forward, because we stand in complete solidarity in the Delta, and particularly at Restore the Delta, but I know our DTEC partners do too, with the drinking water groups of the San Joaquin Valley and the disadvantaged communities in Southern California. When you go through to look at their EJ issues, that doesn't mean, which we see happen a lot in California state government, that the Delta issues and the tribal issues are forgotten. When you are thinking about the co-equal goals, you really have to, if you apply an environmental justice lens, prioritize taking care of the disparate impacts for the people who are impacted from where the resources are extracted, but at the same time, making sure that the people who are going to receive the water that need it the most, people who don't have drinking water in Kern County and along through the San Joaquin Valley, are taken care of first, not powerful economic interests, if you are really going to push forward an inclusion and equity lens in how you manage things through the co-equal goals. And I would add to that, when we bring up our issues just for self-representation, we will get pushback from water contractors about, well, what about the disadvantaged communities of Los Angeles? I personally spent 4 years working in Los Angeles with environmental justice groups on their water issues. There was a point in nearly 20 years of doing this work, I spent more time in LA than I did in the Delta. And to a great degree, ratepayer issues and clean drinking water issues are not being addressed there because of the emphasis on spending money and infrastructure to import water rather than solving problems at the local level. We stand in solidarity. We talk with those groups regularly. So I would say, please, please do the research, because we're for everybody in the Delta. We want to see a sustainable water supply shared, but we have to have those who are in the footprint of everything that is proposed protected. And when you go forward with further research and looking at how water matches up with the co-equal goals that are your mandate, remember that includes reduced reliance on the Delta, and that you can't trade one EJ or tribal community for another. Equity means equity for everyone. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Barbara, and thank you to all of our EJ expert group members who are here today. And I know if you're willing to stay up here a little bit longer, I don't know if any council members have questions or comments for the four of you. So.
Yes, go ahead, Maria.
I understand this distinction that you made about some of the tribes live there, some come back for their cultural. I understand that. But at the same time, I also understand that that climate change and all that impacted, no matter if they live there or they come back. So if we do not peel the onion of who lives, who comes and goes, I mean, the flood is flood, even if you live there or you come there for. So I think it's still essential to do that, because it's important to come up with some kind of understanding of how much of EJ is this and how much is something else for allocation of resources. So that's my point, and I'm thinking maybe you're suggesting maybe a little bit more work probably to peel that onion of who comes and who doesn't come, yes, but at the same time, that impact is an impact, no matter if they live there or not. I mean, that's the land where they
I think we're saying the same thing, because what I want to make sure is that you're not just counting population-wise, but you're remembering those who come back and utilize. Yeah.
Yes.
Council Member Zingali.
Thanks. I just wanted to support the suggestion of getting more specific. And appreciate the observation that even a great paper like this one can end up on a shelf absent that kind of connecting the dots or going to where the rubber hits the road. And I heard a couple from y'all, at least a couple of specific things like the need for warming centers, cooling centers, enforcement of the human right to water and sanitation. And I just would welcome any others now or through your ongoing input with the staff, but I think that is definitely worth considering getting some of those into the recommendations or at least the appendices. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes.
As I stated earlier, I really appreciate all that have contributed to that, and that includes organizations that are represented today. I wanted to say that Sherry's comments related to meaningful consultations is really a very important point, because as I said, we don't want this to be put on a shelf or put in a drawer. We don't want it to be a check the box kind of thing. We want it to be meaningful, and consultation is not telling, it's discussing, it's consulting, it's getting feedback. So I really appreciated that. I don't need to get answers right now, but I'm curious about the mercury discussions, because I know that traditionally, there's been kind of a background level of mercury in our waterways. Then there is mercury levels from industry or disruption of areas. So I'm just curious about kind of where folks are coming from on that issue, but I don't need to hear about it today. I like Gloria talking about the experience of even being new to this and getting to be a part of the discussion. But that kind of goes back to that whole point of, you know, getting to know who's at the table, knowing what resources you need, knowing what experts you need, knowing, you know, what questions to ask your community. So I appreciate that. Bob, I really appreciate the comments that you made. And yes, it's an environmental justice and a civil rights issue. And so you gave me a lot of things to think about. And the fact that 10% of our population is from the indigenous population was an interesting point. Barbara, I appreciate your positive comments. I will be bringing that supermarket for tribes with me. And the point that you made that excluded folks that are not accounted for, it's hard to even account for them because we don't even know where they're, you know, where they are and all of that. Specific language does matter. And I saw Amanda nodding and writing things down as far as the language and the request for more color or on-the-ground meaning to be included in the appendices. And, you know, the process is not perfect. And there's different pulls and pushes coming from different directions. But I think, again, kind of similar to my points earlier, this is indicative of an evolution. It used to be that things were just done and nobody even talked about it. Nobody really even thought about the consequences or who it impacted. And then we started leaning on science and everybody had their scientist. And so then that didn't even agree. And we've kind of come to a place where we have the independent science board. We have kind of we're getting on the same page, but that wasn't including the social sciences, and now that's kind of come in to, you know, be a part of this discussion. And as a result, environmental justice has been lifted up because it's been acknowledged as something that would help. So thank you for contributing. I believe I saw everybody back there with their notebook writing, very, and so you are heard, and you are appreciated, and I thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Any other members? Dan, your hand is still up. Do you want to comment again, or?
No, sorry, I haven't taken it down.
I just wanted to check. I want to thank you all very much for your input as our stakeholder group and for being willing to come here in person. And it's important for us to hear directly from you. So we really, really appreciate the fact that you came here and those of you that participated remotely as well. Just really thankful for the time that you've given to us and your thoughtfulness in what you're wanting to convey. And I think all of us took copious notes. So thank you for that. Amanda, did you have a wrap-up to this?
Yeah, just real okay. Quick, just again, a big, big, huge thank you to Sherry, Gloria, Bob, and Barbara. And then just, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the paper is currently out for public review until November 4th, and then tribal consultation until December 2nd, I think is the date. And then we're planning a lot of outreach. So, and we look forward to more comments from all the council members as well, if you have them. Staff is interested and very curious. I'm very much looking forward to all the other public comments that we anticipate coming to make this a stronger paper. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to the staff. Emma, do we have any public comments on this agenda item?
Yes, we have a public comment from Karen Burr. You should be able to speak now.
Great, thank you, I appreciate it. My name is Karen Burr. I am the Deputy Executive Officer for the Delta Conservancy. And we just wanted to be here with our partners today and really thank and congratulate the council for putting together such a thoughtful and thorough document. We also, you know, acknowledge that there's a long way to go still before this gets to final, but it's such a great and momentous just moment that this is coming out. And I also really appreciate the great conversation that's been happening today. I found it incredibly illuminating And really appreciate that the council's taking the time to go through this and to really address these concerns. And I want to especially just note that the work that the council is doing is really important for the council, but it's also important for all of the state agencies working in the area. We recognize that we need to address these past wrongs, and we are very much looking forward to working in partnership with the council to do that. And we appreciate them taking the lead on, you know, kind of taking these first steps so that we can all work in partnership to address these concerns. So thank you for all the time today. I've learned a ton, and I'm also, you know, really grateful for getting a chance to not only comment on the draft before it came out, but also being able to comment today for the board.
Thank you. Any more comments, Emma?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
All right. It is 11:15 right now. We are going to take a 10-minute comfort break, and we'll be back at 11:25.
Come here, go get comfortable. Comfort break. I borrowed that line. It's a very nice line.
That is courtesy of Maribel Batcher. All right, we're going to get people back in their seats and reconvene here in a moment. Our next agenda item is agenda item 5, consideration and possible adoption of the Delta Plan 5-year review report. This is resolution 2024-08, and we will have council staff presenting to us the 5-year review, summarizing the findings and recommendations of the 5-year review of the Delta Plan. So I'd like to introduce Jeff Henderson, our Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and for Performance, and Martina Kohler, our Program Manager.
Great. Thank you, Chair Lee. It's good to be here today to present the final 2024 Delta Plan 5-year review. I'm Jeff Henderson, Deputy Executive Officer for the Council's Planning Division, and I'm joined by Martina Kohler, our Program Manager for our Performance Measures Unit, who, along with her team, led preparation of this review. Today, we're going to cover the framework of the report, characterize comments that we received during a public comment period, and responses to those comments. We'll also highlight a few of the recommendations, and after receiving any public comments, we'll recommend that the Council approve the report. Next slide, please. So the 5-year review is a requirement of the Delta Reform Act for the Council to evaluate progress implementing Delta Plan policies, recommendations, and performance measures. The Water Code specifically states that the Council shall review the Delta Plan at least once every 5 years and may revise it as the Council deems appropriate. The Reform Act also directs the Council to adaptively manage the Delta Plan. And as part of that, the 5-year review ensures that the Delta Plan responds to changes in the environment, in science, in knowledge, and within the context of the pace and uncertainty of climate change. The first Delta Plan 5-year review was completed in 2019. High-level recommendations from the first review included strengthening plan implementation, evaluating key planning topics and emerging issues, and staff development and technological advancements. We've completed some of these recommendations while others are still in progress. Next slide, please. The Delta Reform Act also includes a requirement that the Delta Plan include performance measurements that enable the Council to track progress in meeting the objectives of the Delta Plan. The Council developed quantitative performance measures in 2013, and we updated them in 2018 and again in 2022 through inclusive processes that involved state, federal, and local agencies, scientists, and interested persons. This 5-year review report uses Delta Plan performance measures to provide a 10-year snapshot of progress toward Delta Plan objectives. Ratings are based on qualitative targets set for each performance measure and consider the portion of each measure's target that's achieved by 2023. Performance measure evaluations are organized into topic-specific report cards, providing a 10-year pulse check of measured progress. And as another part of this work, we reviewed all of the covered actions submitted to the Council since 2013. This included consideration of best available science and adaptive management plans, and led us to recommend a few actions related to early consultation and to ensure that the Delta Plan responds to contemporary issues and opportunities. I'll now hand it over to Martina to provide some background on the draft report.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning, Chair Lee and council members. My name is Martina Koller. I'm the program manager with the Performance Management Unit. I'm really happy to bring to you the final five-year review report. A little bit on the process. Next slide, please. So the public review draft was presented to you at the April 25th council meeting, and that also started the public review period that lasted till June 10th. We received a handful of written public comments, and the draft report was also presented at the Delta ISB meeting during the public comment period. And in response, Delta ISB decided to write a letter to the council regarding the five-year review. The public comments we received addressed mostly the technical aspects of the performance measure assessments and the report cards. The Delta ISB letter was much more broader. They made comments on performance measures as well as the technical assessments, as well as on some of the report recommendations and also on suggestions for future revisions on the performance measures. So in response to the public comments, we made some revisions in the mostly in the technical appendix that kind of summarized the assessments. And then some of the Delta ISB comments also informed some minor revisions on the recommendations that you see in the final report. Next slide. So next, we will go through the report recommendations kind of really quick. We grouped the recommendations into two areas. One is that were drawn from the performance measures and how to improve the performance outcomes. I will go through those, and then I will turn it back to Jeff to go over the recommendations on the regulatory processes. So on the slide here, these are a snapshot. There is one, the top image is for the report card for the ecosystem amendment. Sorry, for the ecosystem, the Delta ecosystem. So the list of the recommendations on the slide, the first two are to strengthen the implementation activities for the reliable water and for the Delta ecosystem restoration, specifically doubling down to implementing the ecosystem chapter recommendations with urgency in mind, because the Delta ecosystem continues to struggle. So the bottom graphic here is on the right is the report card for the Delta S Place. And so the next two recommendations on the list are for the Delta S Place area. First recommendation is really addressing the land subsidence issue, promoting farming that stops subsidence and contributes to carbon sequestration. And the next one is working with our agencies, partner agencies, to expand recreation opportunities and promote heritage and other tourism destinations in the Delta. Next on the list is under the reduced risk category, is advocating for a sustainable levy funding and redouble our efforts to work with federal agencies for their post-disaster assistance with Delta levies. And lastly on the list is consider improvements to the performance measures. During the five-year review process, we identified various areas for that would need future revisions and improvements to the performance measures themselves, and these are presented in the technical appendix to the report. And many of the public comments we received on the draft will inform the future revisions of the performance measures. So with that, I will turn back to Jeff.
All right, next slide, please. The next set of recommendations comes from our regulatory review process that we undertook as part of the five-year review. And these recommendations include continuing to implement the Delta Levees investment strategy, updating the council on recently certified covered action projects, and improving certain aspects of the application of best available science and adaptive management in certifications of consistency. The report also recommends that the council identify frameworks to address new issues, like carbon capture and sequestration and renewable energy, as well as to consider the Delta as an evolving place facing rapid change. Lastly, the report recommends that we implement new climate adaptation and tribal and environmental justice recommendations as directed by the council. And this work will begin once Delta adapts and the EJ issue paper are completed. Next slide, please. So our staff recommendation for today is that following council member questions and public comment on the report, staff recommends the council adopt proposed resolution 2024-08 in your packet, adopting the five-year review report and its recommendations. That concludes our staff report. Happy to respond to any questions.
Yes, Council Member Zingali.
Thanks. I had one just on recommendation number 13 around the paper we just heard about. Now that we have an iteration that's getting closer to what the final will look like, can you give us any more specific idea of what recommendation number 13 might look like in this document as with regards to that paper?
With regard to the EJ, thank you for the question, Council Member Zingali. With regard to the EJ issue paper, the tribal and environmental justice issue paper, there are a number of specific recommendations in that paper. One that comes to mind is the potential adoption of a resolution at a future council meeting setting the council's policy for environmental justice. That would be one of the first actions that would come out as part of number 13. The other thing that we have undertaken is the formation of a climate change and environmental justice unit within the planning division. And within that unit, that's essentially comprised of Morgan and Annika, who you heard from this morning. That unit is essentially charged with putting forward these specific recommendations encompassed within the five-year review, encompassed within Delta Adapts, and encompassed within the tribal and EJ issue paper. So we're looking forward to bringing those papers to completion and then beginning to implement the specific items undertaken there.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Councilmember Burgess.
Thank you. I'm glad we do this every 5 years, and then in between all that, there's other things that are updating and all that. I'm just curious about the assessment measurement tools that were originally set and what's changed, just to get some context. I would imagine that as you do this, you come up with other measurements or other tools, evolve, technology, all of those things. So I just thought it would be interesting to hear what has changed in the period of time that we've done this, and what have we learned as far as the tools to assess and measure what we're doing.
Ask Martina to respond to that one.
Sure. I mean, I think there are kind of two parts of it. Like, first thing is that we do would like some continuity in performance measures, so they are kind of like 10 years, but we do want to continue measuring what we said we want to measure,
right?
But definitely you are right, like identifying new opportunities as far as technology, new monitoring programs that come on board that we could be utilizing. I think good examples are, for example, the remote sensing and satellite imagery.
Right.
That area progressed really tremendously, and we can make use of those, you know, data sources and data sets, as well as additional science. You know, I mean, the connections between like what we want to achieve and then actually how the outcomes on the ground, how that, you know, there is lots of, as you know, lots of kind of unknowns and things that we are learning and the correlation. So there is some new tools from the science and the latest research that we would like to incorporate. So I would refer the technical appendix has actually, we kind of, there are details about the assessments, but almost every performance measure has some recommendation how we could expand as far as the metrics, how we could expand those in those areas. So there is quite a lot that we captured during this process.
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
You go ahead.
Well, the thing is that I find it interesting to, you know, kind of embark on this type of an effort. And the reason why I asked that question was to demonstrate that you're not only doing this work, but you're modeling kind of an adaptive approach to understanding that it's that you didn't define what you were going to figure out and then leave it there. You're remaining curious and allowing more information. And even kind of what we were talking about earlier with the social sciences and, you know, all of those things, it does impact or influence how we look at the data. So I wanted to kind of ask that question to show folks that are watching and interested that this is not just a defined thing that we're just going to keep checking those boxes, but that we're remaining curious and open to all of the other information that's coming in. So,
and in fact, recommendation number 6 in specific is to consider and implement updates to the a certain number of the performance measures. Some of the targets maybe weren't as aggressive as they needed to be. Some maybe were a little undershooting, some overshooting. Different measurements are available today than were available in 2013. And so that technical appendix that Martina referred to includes a number of very specific evaluate whether a change to this measure's target or measure's target or metric or baseline or time frame makes sense based on what we've observed to this point.
Reminds me of Einstein's circle of no. The more you know, the more you don't know. And so the more we know, the more we understand that we need to understand other things. So good stuff.
All right. Any other members? Go ahead, Maria.
Yes, I have one. In terms of the results of the performance, when you do the measurements, are there massive changes or some changes that you find out because of us experiencing climate change and all that? That's one question. And second is that, do you think that these measures might have like two parts of constant measures and variables? And there are certain constant measures that always you need because it tells a story versus things that are changing. So there's two questions that I have.
Yeah, responding to that, so some of the performance measures tie very specifically to maybe I would say hydrologic variability. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, they kind of could incorporate the climate change through those factors, mm-hmm. through the, you know, hydrologic and precipitation and temperature. So they are already designed to be kind of linked to that. And as we assess, we kind of look at the hydrologic conditions. And the other one, you said static versus kind of more changeable. I mean, it kind of depends, I guess, because there is such a broad, you know, measurements that we do. It kind of depends. I mean, we do have some of them that have a very long in the future target dates. Mm-hmm. We have more kind of like an interim, like stepwise assessments that we do mostly around the ecosystem and water quality that we kind of try to address that. So, yeah, the short answer is yes, and it's kind of complex, you know, kind of depending on each performance measure.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Was there anything else on you guys? Okay. Any other members? No. Okay. I'll ask if there's any public comment, and then we'll move on to a possible motion.
We have a public comment from Jay Ziegler online. You should be able to speak now.
Thank you. Can you all hear me?
We can.
Mm-hmm. Great. Madam Chair, members of the council, I'm sorry I couldn't be with you in person today. I also was slow raising my hand, so I'm just going to comment briefly on the Tribal Economic Justice Issue Report, and I really appreciate the extraordinary outreach effort in gaining input of tribes, both in the Legal Delta and beyond, and thinking about how we can more effectively integrate traditional ecological knowledge in restoration and wider objectives. And so I look forward to working with the council in advancing this work and additionally the tribal communities and the greater San Joaquin Delta watershed. So addressing the 5-year update report, I do believe, I want to applaud the work of the staff in developing this 5-year update. I think it gives us a good charter going forward in prioritizing work that can be meaningfully influenced by the council. I do want to highlight that I think that with respect to the objective for Delta ecosystem restoration that we would benefit by taking a sub-regional approach in the Delta, thinking about projects that have strong local support across diverse communities. There are opportunities for recreational expansion in the northwestern Delta, coordinated flood and water quality work in the South Delta, wider work with respect to flood resilience that we can really focus on, I think, that has a real potential to deliver effective multi-benefit projects. And in that spirit, I want to also highlight the importance of the issue with respect to providing security for levees and highlight the importance of integrating a dredging program as part of that effort, that we really are seeing increased circulation problems, especially later in the irrigation season across all water year types virtually, and that we really need to think about an integrated levee program. And finally, in that spirit, I think we should have more attention, and this is an intersectional issue, of course, with the state board, but how we protect water quality values in attaining the dual objectives of the Delta. I think that ultimately how we protect water quality will be perhaps the best indicator we have of whether we're really maintaining all beneficial uses of water and achieving both ecosystem and public health objectives, as well as wider water quality goals in meeting the needs of disadvantaged communities and others that are actively using the Delta. So thank you for your time, effort, and great work in both these areas. And I just wanted to kind of highlight opportunities for integration of these objectives in terms of thinking about tribal inclusion in efforts on the five-year objectives going forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your insightful comments. Emma, is there any other public comments?
No, Madam Chair, there is not.
All right, so I'll just reiterate, I'll entertain a motion for the adoption of the Delta Plan Five-Year Review Report, Resolution 2024-08.
Second.
Did somebody make the motion first?
Oh, I thought you said you.
I can't.
The
no,
motion.
I'm the chair. I'm not allowed to, okay. Unfortunately.
Okay, I'll make the motion.
Okay, Maria.
And I'll second, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice right. Chair Miller. All right. We will proceed with a roll call vote. Eva?
Councilmember Burgess.
Yes.
Councilmember Damrell.
Aye.
Aye. Councilmember Hueso.
Yes.
Councilmember Maronian.
Yes.
Vice Chair Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Zingali.
Yes.
Chair Lee.
Aye. All right, we have a unanimous vote that passes. And we will go on to our agenda item number 6, which is our consent calendar. Items for consent calendar are expected to be routine and non-controversial. The council will be asked to approve items on the consent calendar one at a time. If any council member, staff, or interested persons asked for the item to be removed, it can be removed, and we can take it up later at the discretion of the chair. So we have one item on the consent calendar, which is the adoption of the August 22nd, 2024 meeting summary. Members, I'll ask if there's any need for any discussion on any of these items on the consent calendar.
Madam Chair, since I wasn't there, should I recuse myself?
You can, if you'd like, yes.
Okay.
All right, and before we vote on this... Before we vote, are there any public comments on the items on the consent calendar?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
All right. If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve these items.
So move.
I'll move approval.
Sorry, I missed. The judge is making a motion. Okay. Thank you, Judge Damrell.
Second.
And Maria seconds. Thank you. And we will proceed with a roll call vote.
Councilmember Burgess.
I will recuse myself since I wasn't there.
Councilmember Damrell.
Aye.
Councilmember Hueso.
Aye.
Councilmember Maronian.
Aye.
Vice Chair Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Zingali.
Aye.
Chair Lee.
Aye.
The motion passes.
The motion passes unanimously. And it is 11:50. We will take our lunch break now, and we will come back at 1 p.m., and that is a little bit of a time change for people that are tracking that. So 1 p.m. we will return. Thank you. Hi, welcome back. We're going to reconvene our Delta Stewardship Council meeting. It is 1:02. Our next agenda item is the chair's report. So just briefly, I'm going to do a little bit of a look ahead. October's shaping up to be quite a busy month. We've got the Bay Delta Conference, which is next week, and Dr. Lisa Marie Wyndham Myers is going to talk a little bit more about that. And we've got our DPIC meeting at the end of October. This is our autumn gathering, and we will be discussing levies and being on a bit of a field trip. Do any other members have any updates or anything for the chair report that they'd like to speak on? Nope. Okay. Are there any public comments on this item, Emma?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
We can move on to agenda item number 8, the executive officer's report, and I will turn it over to Jessica Pearson.
Okay, thank you, and good afternoon. Excited to be here in Stockton and a new venue for us, which has been great. I wanted to express my sincere appreciation for this morning's panel and our tribal communities and community-based organizations and the council staff for all their hard work on the issue paper draft, and we're excited that that's out for review, looking forward to improvements and feedback. This month, I just wanted to highlight some really good news in the Delta. We saw the completion of the Delta's largest ever tidal wetland restoration project, the Lookout Slough Project. This project plays a significant role in moving us towards the shared ecosystem and flood protection goals set forth in the Delta Plan. And on September 18th, I had the pleasure of joining our lead scientist and council staff and federal USGS Water Science Center staff at the levee breaching ceremony, which was pretty exciting. We got to see the excavator breach one of the levee breaches and see the beginning of the flood up of the habitat. And so we've got some pictures here on the screen from that outing. You can see the people on the land side who were gathered for the DWR ceremony, and then we were out in the research boat, and the very nimble and experienced excavator operator, also very patient, had been sitting there for hours, I think, waiting for the time to breach the levee. And what you're seeing only a portion of the levee that was breached, and it did take probably 30 minutes to even clear that small section. And then consider that there are like 8 more breaches that are about 10 times the size of what you see there, and you get to start to get a sense for the scale of this project, which is 3,400 acres of habitat for fish and other wildlife, and also increases up to a 100-year flood protection level for some of the surrounding communities. So projects of this scale are rare in the Delta, maybe a few times in a career, so definitely something to celebrate, and I was excited to be part of that. And then looking ahead, coming up this fall, we have our Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee Autumn Gathering, which we're going to hold at the Bogle Winery in Clarksburg, and that's on Monday, October 28th. That meeting is going to focus on Delta levees, challenges, and opportunities, and it will include hopefully a short walk of the levee surrounding Bogle, so a walk and talk component as well. So the public is invited to that. Look for more information on our website. We have not had any covered actions filed in the last 30 days, but we do include our list of active projects, which is in your packet and online for the public's review and tracking. In your packet, we also have one comment letter that we sent in late August to the Department of Water Resources. This is regarding their notice of preparation for an environmental impact report for the Tides End multi-benefit restoration project. This is in the downstream end of the Yolo Bypass in Yolo County, and the goal of that project is to restore tidal marsh and associated floodplain habitat. while also preserving and enhancing existing land uses as part of a voluntary agreement that is part of what the State Water Board is considering. This project appears to meet the definition of a covered action, and so the council invited DWR to engage with council staff in early consultation prior to their submittal of a certification of consistency so that we can discuss project features and mitigation measures that would promote consistency with the Delta Plan. Also in your packet this month, we have our outreach highlights report, and one of the things I want to flag for you there, if you enjoy podcasts, as I do, and you want to learn more about harmful algal blooms, we have a California Sea Grant Fellow, Dane Wicker, who is with the council right now, who interviewed subject matter experts on HABs and created what's the debut episode of our new podcast, The Delta Dispatch. So it's really well done and informative, and I highly recommend it. I think it's about 40 minutes long. We also, our Delta Science program, worked with our communications team to promote new graphics for the Bay Delta Science Conference, which is coming up next week. And this is also for attendees and presenters to share on their social media platforms to promote the event and enhance engagement. They're a really great tool for the presenters to highlight their sessions, what they're going to talk about, and garner more interest. And now I'm going to hand it over to Brandon Chapin, our legislative and policy advisor, to provide a little end of session wrap up.
Thanks, Jessica. Good morning, Chair and Council members. I'll start off by just referencing back to the discussion we had earlier about the Tribal and Environmental Justice Issue Paper and opportunities for the Council to get involved in various different EJ legislative priorities. This, I think, is the example of where it would come to you all throughout the year, working with the chair and you all to try to find where those opportunities might be as they arise in the legislative session and the cycle. So while I go through a few of these bills, I'll highlight some of those that, for example, EJ option or EJ bills that come up. If we can get the next slide, please. So first is AB 460 by Assemblymember Bauer Cahan. This has been a bill that's been going through the legislature for the last 2 years. Focused on penalties for illegal diversions from water rights. This was signed by Governor Newsom earlier this month and sets various different fines and penalties that the State Water Board can assess on water rights abusers, either through not following through on an order or illegal diverting in general. Next slide, please. An example of one for of tribal and environmental justice implications is AB 1284 by Assemblymember Ramos. This authorizes the Secretary of Natural Resources to delegate or enter into co-governance or management agreements with federally recognized tribes for the purpose of shared responsibility and decision-making for resource management and conservation. This has been something really big with state parks in particular, as well as other opportunities. This has passed the legislature and is awaiting the governor's decision whether to sign or veto it by the end of the month. He has a deadline of September 30th to take action on any of these bills. Next slide, please. Next is AB 1581. This is kind of going into streamlining some of the permitting processes for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so it's known as the Restoration Management Permit Act and authorizes the department to issue restoration management purposes for the authorization of take, possession, import or export of species, and really streamlines their process. This one also is awaiting signature or veto from the governor by the end of the month. Next slide, please. AB 1992 by Assemblymember Berner. It deals with blue carbon and teal carbon sequestration projects. This is something that was of particular interest to lead scientist Wyndham Myers. This would have authorized the Secretary of Natural Resources to move forward on blue carbon demonstration projects in the ocean, as well as teal carbon demonstration projects that are in freshwater areas. And actually, I might put Dr. Wyndham Myers on the spot really quick if you want to give a quick explainer of what blue and teal carbon might be. Sorry, I should have given you a warning.
No, you were fine. So yeah, I think the colors of carbon is the way people try to separate, you know, different pathways by which carbon gets sequestered, and blue tends to be called ocean-based, and teal tends to be considered used for inland-based, but ultimately means connected to the ocean or not connected to the ocean. That's what it means.
Yeah. And these are carbon sequestration projects in the ocean in these areas. This bill was vetoed by Governor Newsom, though, under the budget constraints that the state is in right now, and requested that it be done through the budget process going forward due to the cost of this of these kind of bills. Next slide, please. Next is AB 2875 by Assemblymember Friedman. This relates to state policy for wetlands. It establishes a state policy of no net loss and net gain of wetlands in the state. This was just recently signed by Governor Newsom, I believe yesterday or the day before, and really coincides with the council's ecosystem restoration as well as the 30 by 30 initiative of the state. Next is next slide, please. SB 366 by Senator Caballero. This one I've brought up throughout the year. This one would have recast the provisions that the Department of Water Resources has to use for drafting the California Water Plan that it puts out every 5 years, and also would have required the setting of various different water supply targets. This bill was vetoed by Governor Newsom yesterday, along with the other actions that he took, for similar reasons as the blue carbon sequestration bill for costs associated with the bill. Next slide, please. In my rush to put together this presentation, I realized I put the wrong bill here. This is still an important bill, but the one that was meant for this slide was SB 1390. This one was also by Senator Caballero. And this had to deal with allowing for flood flow diversion for groundwater recharge. This ultimately did not make it out of the legislature and was on the last day was left on the floor of the assembly. And then lastly, one other bill, and this again ties back to the tribal and EJ issue paper, is AB 3017 by Assemblymember Hart. This one's on page 6 of the bill report. This would allow for the state to contract with tribes and provide up to 25% of the contract amount ahead of time. So this is one of the examples of something that I think is identified in the tribal and EJ issue paper of constraints that state contracting can often impose on tribes. So this is trying to address that. And this one also is still awaiting a decision by the governor and on the governor's desk.
Brandon, when you talk about urban retail water suppliers, does that include wastewater treatment retailers?
You're referencing 1330. I'd have to look back on the bill for that one. Like I said, I accidentally put that in.
Okay.
In the presentation that I would prepare for.
It's in front of me, so I was reading it, and then it got me thinking. But you know, I'm trying to think of ways that we can help encourage the lawmakers to consider all water supplies as far as urban retail, because not everybody needs it for drinking water. And mm-hmm. so if we can do better by expanding that and giving people access to that, that would be great.
Sounds good. I should note for SB 1330, that one was held up on suspense this past year, but... So those are the bills. The one last thing I just want to mention that's I think celebratory and great for the Bay Delta Science Conference is one of our plenary speakers on Monday will be Assemblymember Lori Wilson, who's going to come and provide some introductory remarks about how science influences decision making and also as well as how just representing the Delta in general. So we're excited to have her and provide some brief remarks at the conference. With that, I'll open it up to any questions. Or any further questions?
I don't don't see any.
Okay.
Thank you
much. Brandon.
Thank you.
So looking ahead at the rest of the agenda, we're going to hear from Dr. Wyndham Myers and the Delta Lead Scientist Report, and then an update from our Delta Watermaster's Office, including information from the newly released report on the Water Year 2023 Delta Drought Response Pilot Program. And then finally, we have Carrie Buckman from the Department of Water Resources to give us an update on the Delta Conveyance Project planning and permitting schedule. And with that, I conclude my executive officer's report. Thank you.
Thank you. Any members have any questions for Jessica? No? Do we have any public comments?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have an online public comment from OSHA Meserve. You should be able to speak now.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you.
Oh, great. Thank you. OSHA Meserve for local agencies of the North Delta. I just wanted to comment briefly on the Lookout Slough project that the executive director mentioned. There's some misstatements being made about this project, and I just want to clarify for the record, and you could be available to, you know, provide additional follow-up as necessary. But I think it's important to note that this 3,400-acre project is not complete. It will take years to complete. I've been told by DWR's council that it's like through 2025 they'll be constructing. So it's incorrect to call this project complete. Also, it's incorrect to say that this is a flood protection project. What this project did is it set back an existing levee, so it maintained the flood protection level for the area. It doesn't really increase flood protection, and that was one of the reasons that local agencies and Central Delta Water Agency, among others, objected to the provision of Prop 1 flood money for this project, because it's primarily a restoration project meant to meet state and federal water project obligations under their biological opinion. There's specific information around the flood protection, but the most it increases protection is 0.5 inch in the northeastern corner of the site. So it's really not a flood protection project. It's good. It didn't make flood protection worse, but it doesn't make it better either. And also, I think there's a long-term concern of Delta folks regarding whether there would be adequate monitoring and mitigation for this project. Because those new channels were being created, one of which was breached last week, that will be new area that harmful algal blooms and invasive aquatic weeds can potentially thrive. And I know with respect to the mitigation and the environmental review, we did not think that it was adequate. So, I think this is an important issue for the council as it promotes habitat restoration, that there be the long-term monitoring and remediation, if necessary, of these kinds of issues. In addition, best available science around the monitoring that what happens when you increase the tidal range and what happens to salinity in other parts of the Delta is important. And if I see my time's running out, but I'm almost done, if that's all right, Chair.
Yeah, go ahead and wrap up. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess, and the last thing I'll say is just, I think the process for this project, it would have benefited from early implementation of the policy around good neighbors for restoration that the council has promoted in its most recent update. So I just want to flag those issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Emma, were there any other public comments?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
All righty. We will move on to agenda item number 9, our lead scientist report, and I will turn it over to Dr. Lisa Marie Wyndham Myers.
Great, thank you, Chair Lee. Super. I think I'll start with the paper that I wanted to highlight at today's meeting. Can we put the graphic up on the screen. Thank you so much. So this paper that I'm highlighting came out in February of this year, and it was the cover story of a really prestigious journal called Nature Water. So it's a focus on water. And what was so great about it was the accuracy that was shown to be achievable for measuring the consumptive use of water on lands, particularly irrigated lands, across the U.S. And the purpose of the paper was to basically intercompare the models that they've been using remotely sensed data, so images from the sky, how green it is, how wet it is, how hot it is on the land, use these images to then calculate how much water is being transpired through the plants out to the atmosphere, so the consumptive use of water by plants, basically. And ET basically means evapotranspiration, so it's a combination of evaporation and transpiration. Transpiration being through plants, evaporation off of a surface, any kind of surface. So anyway, what's so wonderful about the paper was how it showed through 45 years of data going back in time, validation data and imagery going back in time, and 161 sites in the end were used across the country, and they were able to get 90% accuracy within 90% of what you would expect. And the beauty of it was both super precise, meaning if a value was was calculated, it was within 10% error of being accurate, which is about as good as you can possibly do. Sorry, that's for precision. And then accuracy means that it wasn't biased. So when it gives you a number, it's really that number. It's not biased high, it's not biased low. So the paper was incredibly rigorous. The tool, OpenET, did so well in the West in particular because we don't have as many clouds as the Eastern U.S. So it worked okay in the Eastern U.S., but it worked really good in the West and in particularly in California and particularly in the Delta. So it's a tool that just, you know, should be more widely adopted now. The places where it didn't do well, so it did well against all crops, all the crops, row crops, orchards, vineyards, did fantastic. Didn't do that great in natural lands, so open water, aquatic systems like wetlands, some forests. It was good, you know, let's say maybe 60%, 80% accuracy, but it biased a little high. It wasn't perfect, but that's where now the next generation of tests will be done, is on sort of zeroing in on those unique ecosystems that need a little bit more attention. But for irrigated agriculture, was just absolutely amazing. So it's a tool that I really highly suggest that we adopt to help with things like water conservation, to let, you know, farmers can use it to understand how shifts that they've made in drip irrigation or shifts in crops have changed their water usage. These are lands that aren't metered, so it's really hard to get a number for how much water is being used, and this tool is incredibly accurate. So,
trying to understand the gist of it is that, so if there is, if the irrigation happens on the land that is not farmed, after some certain point, there's no impact. Is that what? Tell me what the conclusion was of the study. One more time, please.
Yeah, the conclusion is that this tool, this using these remotely sensed data from satellites, particularly like Landsat and Sentinel, optical satellites, using the information from that into a series of models, they then have an ensemble model, which is like takes all six of them and makes the best story. That is so accurate that you almost don't need meters or to measure siphoned off water on these lands, because you can measure the amount of water used directly using satellites. So you get like super accurate number.
Okay, I got it. And then it doesn't, so there's nothing about, for some reason I was confused, farmed land versus non-farmed. Mm. There's nothing there. It's only for farmed land.
Right? It works great for farmed land.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Not as good. It's still good in natural lands, but it's less good. It's particularly good in farmed lands.
Thank you.
Yeah. You must. Yeah, and so
Councilmember Burgess has another question.
Oh, yes.
So this brings up something that I heard in a presentation recently that I'm curious about. I'm not saying is true or not true because I don't have enough information, but in this conversation when you're talking about using it for ag versus restoration and how useful it is, somebody said that the amount of water used for ag is minimal comparatively to what the amount of water people need for restoration, and that there's a significant amount of water needed for restoration in the Delta versus for ag. Is that true? And if this isn't the time, maybe you could come back later, but these tools would probably be what would be used to help determine that.
Yeah, and thank you for pointing that out. Different crops use different amounts. I mean, two that are particularly high are like corn and walnuts happen to just have high water use. But in general, there is a high use in wetlands, yes, because there's a high leaf area. Just think about all those green surfaces. But it's not, I think the math really has to be done on when the water is being used. And if it's at the peak of the growing season, which is actually when this tool works best, the amounts can be very similar between crops, and then crops have a shorter life on land, you know, they get harvested, and so there's no more water use, whereas the wetland keeps using it, but maybe it's using it through a time where there's more water available. So I think the whole thought process by how we assess how much water is being used should be taken into account the delivery or the availability of water on the landscape. So it's possible I could give you some numbers, but they're all sort of loose.
It was just an interesting idea that I hadn't really thought of, but basically they're saying to grow this crop, whether it's whatever it is, I think in this presentation they were saying that grapes was what was primarily being looked at, but that restoration work has significant water needs comparatively to what ag doesn't really need additional water because of the way it is. It was just an interesting thing, and when you're talking about how can we look at that, then the question is about like the flows through the Delta and how much water is needed for different things. And so if we're doing a lot of restoration work, then there's, I don't know what the percentages, if it's significant amounts of water needed just to be able to do those things, but I'm glad we have tools that are getting more accurate so that we can be aware of what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, a plus side I have to throw out too, though, is, I mean, some people call this like plant sweating. It's one way that the atmosphere cools by having evapotranspiration. So it's there's actually can sometimes be a climate benefit to having evaporation. It's a use of water, but anyway. So I think another thing to just plug is that the through an agreement that the Department of Water Resources and the State Water Board have instituted, people are getting trained up on using this tool, and that includes folks in the planning division of the Delta Stewardship Council, and they're going to try to start using it to quantify daily, monthly, and annual ET across different land use types, getting at the question you're asking. Councilmember Burgess, and you know, it might become a performance measure at some point because it's something that's at that level of accuracy, so it's pretty cool. And I think you might hear more about this from the Delta Water Master in the next presentation. So let me move forward then with the different activities going on. All right. So the Delta Research Awards have now, we've received all of the applications for this, and we've gotten 66 applications. A total of $6 million will be granted. But from those applications, they're asking for more like $60 million. So just to highlight the incredible opportunities that we're going to be missing because we do not have the funds to support, you know, $60 million worth of work. But we do have partners and other agencies that we'll probably be working with to help fund some of those projects because there's some really wonderful science being proposed. You will probably hear about this at the February 2025 council meeting once all the reviews are done. The panels have just been put together. Sea Grant runs this for us, the California Sea Grant, the review process and the whole recruiting process. And so they have started putting together those panels, and so we expect to have some announcements in February and then perhaps have start dates in April. So those are the research awards. The next is the Delta Science Fellowships, again, run in partnership with California Sea Grant. And the last cohort has now been, they've put out, we've gotten 23 applications for that cohort. They're undergoing review right now. Again, the breadth of topics is everything, you know, across the science spectrum, including social science, and the 23 applications are being reviewed. The final selections will be made, I think, during the winter period, and then perhaps at the January 2025 meeting, we'll be talking about which science fellowships will be given out to which fellows. All right. And then the next thing to talk about is a meeting that just happened the last 3 days that I was present at. It was the California Water and Environmental Modeling Forum, their annual meeting. And I was at the Lake Natoma Inn in Folsom, California. And it was a really eye-opening session for me. Eye-opening meeting for me. It was the 30th anniversary of this modeling forum that tries to look at water and environmental issues across the state of California, and they've been calling for integrated modeling for 30 years. This is a team of people that really want to work together across different agencies, broad agency and different science entities entities present from federal to private entities and so on. It was just a great session. And we actually, at the very last day, at the very last session, had a session that we called The Collaboratory Starts Now. And we basically invited everyone in the room to put their feedback in and how we are starting to move forward on facilitating a collaborative effort across multiple agencies with a goal of starting with use cases, starting with an actionable question that needs to be addressed and bringing together teams to start addressing those questions. So in our session, which was organized by Maggie Christman and Ben Geske and myself, and Denise Colombano also joined in for this. In our session, we brought together use cases that were everything from harmful algal bloom forecasting. NOAA sent somebody to talk about life history modeling of salmon with water management. The UC collaborative co-equal presented on water allocation decision making. And Department of Water Resources also made a presentation on integrated ecological programs, tidal marsh food webs synthesis work that they're starting to do, so to understand what's the best way to restore a tidal marsh to actually get food into the species that we care about. And then the USGS had a talk about their integrated modeling framework called Cascade, which is computational assessments of scenarios of change in the Delta ecosystem. And it's everything from climate drivers through the entire food web and all the water supplies all the way down to, for example, clams. I mean, it's just the full spectrum. So anyway, those were the talks. Great feedback, wonderful session. I know that we'll be involved with QEMF moving forward because we were suggested to be the plenary speakers next year. So I think we will stay connected with QEMF and start moving forwards on those work groups. So that was a great last couple days for me. Okay, on our radar coming up, Chair Lee mentioned the Bay Delta Science Conference. It is, in fact, next week, downtown Sacramento. We have, the latest I heard was about 800 registrations, but it may have updated since because I haven't heard for about a week. And the focuses at the meeting are, I've been through them before, but it's, the full suite of science that is being done in the Delta, and the Bay Delta in general, the entire estuary, but a focus on the Delta in particular. We have multiple fellows that from the previous research awards, so 2022 research awards. We have the science awards that we've given out, for example, the Delta Research Awards that we gave out in 2022, most of them are being presented at the meeting. So that includes, for example, work on reorienting to recovery for salmon. It includes the Phragmites control questions and the social aspects of how people control this invasive plant on their lands. There's a session on that. There's a large tribal knowledge component across the days. In particular, on day two, there's a training on how to, and this I think this topic came up earlier, how to use tribal knowledge in a fair way, and honoring the sovereignty of and the ownership of that data. That's on day two. And then on day three, there's another session on tribal perspectives on restoring salmon to the watersheds, in particular the McLeod River. So I want to highlight those, considering we just had the EJ presentation, tribal and EJ. And day one is, again, a lot of awards giving out. The plenary sessions are amazing, so I will just highlight that we have Don Hankins from Chico State. We have Diana Almendriz talking about fire in the restoration of ecosystem properties, and then we have in water quality, and then we also have Karen Morrison talking about pesticide regulation and how that's been improved and where the challenges are. So the breadth of topics is all available online. I highly recommend attending all 3 days, but in particular, I've only shared with you some of the highlights that might be of interest to you, but glad to talk about any more, including harmful algal blooms has a bunch of sessions, and fisheries has a lot of sessions as well. Okay, and then the last thing to plug is a Zoom lunchtime call coming up on October 8th. That's going to be an informational webinar on how to use the Delta Science Tracker, what to use from there, why use it, a lot of the background of why we have a science tracker and what you can do with it. So if you're interested, just generally interested in better access to the work being done in the Delta from a scientific perspective, so research insights, tracking funding and expenditures for these different projects, and just basically making these connections with other science groups you may not be familiar with. The Science Tracker provides an entree for the whole community to become more connected. So again, the link is in here if you want to join that Zoom call. And that's on October 8th, so about 2 weeks. And that's the only updates I have besides by the numbers. Okay, so let's just look at our data here. So we haven't updated our by the numbers yet to get in our harmful algal blooms. We're going to save that for next month. But what this does show you is the same layout that we've been looking at all this time. And again, a lot of consistency here. So all of the reservoirs are at about average, if nothing, a little bit higher than average. The water flow and quality data, things are looking a lot like they did again in August. One good thing was that, I don't know if you can see for the data at Vernalis, which is where the San Joaquin River flow is being measured, we're out of the red. We're no longer in the red zone. it's gone up from about 800 to now we're over 1,000 cubic feet per second. So the flows there have increased. Maybe through lower crop usage. I'm not really sure why it's increased. I'm not sure for that. But obviously the San Luis Reservoir is fairly high, so there's plenty of water in there. Then we have the diversions, or the exports are basically the same. So towards temperatures, let's just take a quick peek there. Again, the system is holding steady, looking pretty much like the historic 20-year average for all of our sites. No real story there. We have enough water in the reservoirs to keep Clear Creek at about where it's supposed to be, about 57 degrees, 58 degrees. And the last thing is just to point to, yeah, rainfall averages are pretty much what they've historically been, so no real story there. And, yeah, there's no real big news to report in by the numbers this time around, but perhaps when we look at this in October, we'll have some report out on where we are with harmful algal blooms for the year. And that's about it.
Great. Any questions?
Yes,
Councilmember Burgess.
So as we approach, now that we're in fall, what are the models saying as far as El Nino and La Nina and the what we're expecting as far as precipitation for this coming year?
Yeah, it's we're looking at an El Nino coming in. We're going to swing into one. I think the things are converging on that. So probably a wetter north and a drier south, given the past history of how things get distributed. Mm-hmm. So, it's a projection, but that's where we're headed.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Do we have any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair, we do not.
All righty. Thank you. We will move on to agenda item 10, which is our Delta Water Master, whose title my husband thinks is the greatest title in all of state service. Jay sure. Ziegler is going to report for us. Hi, Mr. Ziegler.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the council. Nice to have a chance to talk with you today, if not in person, at least via the web here. So I appreciate the chance to kind of report in. Could we go to the next slide, please? So what I'm going to talk about, as the Delta lead scientist noted, is thinking about the use of OpenET and measuring consumptive use in the Delta. And in particular, I want to give credit to my predecessor, Michael George, for really initiating and all stakeholders' engagement in thinking about the best path forward to measure water use in the legal Delta. And this work began in earnest upon passage of Senate Bill 88 back in 2015. It has progressed through a number of different experiments in what continues as the Delta Measurement Experimental Consortium, administered by the Office of the Delta Water Master. And out of that process, in 2019, the stakeholders across the Delta essentially came to a conclusion that OpenET represented the most reliable, feasible, and accurate methodology to measure consumptive use in the Delta. Next slide, please. So as the story unfolded, it took a number of years to actually get software alignment integration with the OpenET data set. In thinking about the current water year and where we're at, is that almost two-thirds of Delta water users, and I really give credit to the Central Delta and South Delta Water Agencies for both thought leadership and funding an alternative approach to measuring water use in the Delta. So today we're at a point where 2/3 of Delta water users are reporting on the deltaacp.com platform. We are also seeing wider usage of OpenET water use index, looking at how much water plants actually use and being able to report that data out. And then we have a series of tailored alternative compliance plans that represent the balance. But overall, we have 95% of water users reporting their water use across the legal Delta. That is exponentially better than the compliance rate we see at a state level. And in thinking about the 420,000 irrigated agricultural acres across the Delta, there are approximately 1,300 water rights users and 3,000 points of diversion. And the reason this methodology became so attractive to Delta water users was really borne out in a study that Metropolitan did in a pilot that they're doing where they are actually metering their siphon gauges or and applying gauges on all of their siphons on the four metropolitan islands. And what they found is that it's a cost of $10,000 to $20,000 per siphon to implement that system. And so if you took that across the Delta, across 3,000 points of diversion, you're looking at a cost of $30 to $60 million if we implemented a conventional siphon gauge monitoring system. So that gives you a sense of kind of I think the reason why we had to find an alternative methodology for water data reporting in the Delta. Next slide, please. And so in thinking about where we are today, I think there's a graphical picture that gives you kind of a good sense of overall compliance in the Delta and again, where we are today. Next slide, please. Finally, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about the Delta Drought Response Pilot Program. And I want to give credit to the Department of Water Resources, Director Nemeth, Tom Gibson, and others that set aside an $11 million program to see what kinds of results we could have across testing across multiple water years in thinking about how we might conserve water in the Delta to benefit in-stream flow and actually show a correlation between water conservation practices. So that could include fallowing of land, could include deficit irrigation, so putting 18 inches of water on corn instead of 36 inches, and it might include crop substitution, so growing a lower water-intensive crop instead of a more water-intensive crop. And so what we found based again, on the ability to use the OpenET platform to uniformly index water use across the Delta was really quite encouraging. So in the water year 23, there were 109 bids received for water conservation programs across the legal Delta. 61 unique projects were selected, involving almost 40 farmers across more than 10,000 acres. So it was a really great sampling different practices and across the geography holistically in the Delta. Next slide, please. And so with this in mind, there are multiple objectives beyond water savings and in-stream benefits, which also include water quality and habitat benefits, which the Nature Conservancy has been deeply involved in, and an assessment of soil health impacts as well. Next slide, please. And then what we learned. So across all of these experiments, what we really found is that the level of practices did not produce anticipated savings with respect to in-Delta conservation. In sum, a direct reduction in applied water in the Delta does not correlate to in-stream flow benefit. And so what we did find is that the upland areas in the Delta show greater potential. It's in part the higher elevation means a lower reliance on the high water table, which is replete across the deeply subsided lands, which represent about a third of the farmed acreage in the Delta. But overall, what the results told us was that while these practices might not be beneficial for in-stream flow benefits directly in the legal Delta, they may have significant benefit if applied immediately upstream in the Delta. So that's an area where we're continuing to do work. And as the Delta Science Program Director noted, we're also looking at refinement of the open water ET budget in relation to Supervisor Burgess's question about looking at comparative levels for restoration and how much ET we're actually seeing on those lands as compared to cultivated agriculture. Next slide, please. So in sum, this was really an amazing partnership. It rode on the backs of really the Delta Farmers, Delta Water Agencies, tremendous work by Rachel Lane, Rachel Wadsworth, and Campbell Ingram at the Delta Conservancy, kind of cross-analysis of the ET data and methodology in my office, and again, a focus in the, from the Nature Conservancy's perspective on how to continue to budget water for habitat values in the Delta, even amid drought years. So next slide, please. So with that, I just want to say that, again, a big thank you to the Department of Water Resources for setting aside budget resources for the 22 and 23 water years to really look at what conservation practices in the Delta might mean for beneficial in-stream flow effects. And through the work of the Delta Measurement Experimental Consortium, my office is continuing to look at a number of aspects in thinking about the alignment of specific irrigation practices at different elevations across different crop types, and a comparison of the open water and habitat restoration values that we see in open ET. And the reason this is so important, and again, the Delta lead scientist alluded to this, is that we really need to look at multiple data indices to better understand consumptive use dynamics, not just in the legal Delta, but really in the entire watershed. And then to look more deeply at both groundwater and surface water budgets together and what they're telling us about water use, what they're telling us about what higher temperatures mean for evaporation, that is water just disappearing in the atmosphere that we used to count on showing up in stream flow. And so putting these tools together, we're really excited about, one, the adoption across the Delta in getting to a comfort level of using OpenET to really provide a common baseline so that we can all better understand actual consumptive use in the Delta. And the Delta Drought Response Pilot Program was a great series of experiments to look at both a really dry year in 22 and a really wet year, and what those different years can tell us about the need to really think holistically about water use and conservation practices, not just in the Delta, but again, immediately upstream of the Delta, and where we can actually achieve, where conservation benefit can more directly correlate with in-stream flow benefit. So thank you for your time, and appreciate any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting. Do any of our council members have any questions for Mr. Ziegler? No? All right. Thank you very much again. We will move on to agenda item.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry. I got through almost the whole meeting, remembering. So close. Okay. Are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Agenda item 11 is the California Department of Water Resources Delta Conveyance Update, and we will welcome Carrie Buckman from the Environmental Program Area at DWR. Thank you, Carrie, for being here.
Good afternoon.
Good
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Chair Lee, for having me and to the members of the council. I'm looking forward to my regular update. I'm going to talk a little bit today about the next steps on the community benefits program development and ongoing activities related to permitting and what's coming up next there as well. Next slide, please. So I wanted to start with the community benefits program update. I know that we've seen this probably, I don't know, a million times conservatively, but just as a reminder for where we are, some place setting, we are looking at developing a community benefits program as part of the Delta Conveyance Program in recognition that the benefits of the project are received by the state water contractors, but the impacts are in the Delta in an area that doesn't receive direct benefits. And we've worked through CEQA, really through conceptual design as well, and CEQA to try to reduce and mitigate those impacts. But we recognize that CEQA is pretty prescriptive. It doesn't always address all of the types of adverse effects that may be felt by communities. So next slide. So we have developed an idea of a framework of the community benefits program. And actually, as we're moving it forward, we've split this out just a little differently than what you've seen before. So the Delta Community Fund is the same. The idea is that this is a grant funding program for a broad array of community prioritized projects in the Delta. And early input from the communities identified examples of different categories could include recreation, water and air quality, public safety and emergency response, habitat conservation, culture and history, economy, infrastructure, education and workforce development, and levy maintenance and improvement. So we're still trying to work out the details of how the program would work, but our current thought is that qualified projects would be funded on a first-come, first-served basis with technical assistance provided to all applicants. The economic development and integrated benefits we have split into two categories. I think in the past when I've talked to you, we've lumped those together, but we are thinking about them these days as two different things. So for economic development, the idea is that these are targeted benefits that would be realized through construction of the project facilities, including targeted hiring, job training, and business participation programs. So as we're looking at the budget for the community benefit program, the part of that activity that would hit the budget as part of the community benefits program would be the expenses like staffing to administer the program and monitor the progress towards the targets. The labor itself is part of the construction budget, so that kind of labor doesn't directly hit the community benefits program. And then the last category on here is integrated benefits. And the idea here is that we may have what we sometimes call leave behinds, where we have we modify or change some of the temporary infrastructure so that it can benefit the community after construction. It could be things like we have a park and ride that we're constructing. If the community wants it after construction, we could update it, modify it, and turn it over to the local entity instead of removing it, which is our current plan. So the cost of this is how it sort of accrues to the community benefit program is the increment. So the cost to design and construct the facility to begin with is part of the project facility, but the increment that's associated with the leave behind would be considered to be part of the community benefits program. We're also working on community benefit agreements with specific local entities, and that's an agreement that is really specific to the entity to think about what could be achieved. It could include a combination of all three items, but it's really trying to focus and help develop ideas with a specific local entity. Next slide, please. So our next step here is that we've developed an initial idea of an implementation plan. And so this implementation plan has information about how to structure the three components of the community benefit program. It has ideas about scheduling of grant solicitation periods, identification of integrated benefits, and development of community benefit agreements. And it has ideas of how we could screen and score grant proposals for eligibility and prioritization. And I really want to flag here, the most important part of this is that it's just an idea. We asked a lot of questions when we reached out to communities, and it's pretty hard if we're saying things like, how should we score these grants? They're like, we're not sure. Like, it's hard to do that. It's hard to come up with something out of thin air. So what we're hoping is that by having this initial draft to react to and respond to, it will be a starting point for development. In no way are we committed to this at all. It's just an idea for response and development. Next slide, please. So this looks at where we're going from here with the community benefit program development. And I'd say there are sort of three key time periods to think about. So one is from now until when construction begins. And during that time, we're working on developing the draft and final implementation plan. We're working to identify integrated benefits. Many of those things would need to be included as part of the original construction packages. So we want to make sure that we have those developed before construction begins. We're also working to develop community benefit agreements and working on our final permits and approval. So when construction begins, it will begin on some components, but we're not going to have all construction begin at the same time. So construction will start with early works like bringing power and road work, and those things will start while the final designs are being done for other facilities. So there's sort of this interim phase where some construction is beginning, but there's still also quite a bit of design work going on some of the larger facilities. So during that time, we will be starting grant distribution. We're also working to continue to identify integrated benefits and then implement those that have come up, monitoring and oversight of economic development, and then also continuing to develop and implement community benefits agreements. So once the designs are complete and everything is in construction, we're kind of limited on our ability to continue to develop some of these ideas. At that point, it will be hard to continue to develop integrated benefits. So we shift into things like we're just going to be distributing grants, implementing the integrated benefits, and then monitoring and oversight economic development. We would no longer be looking to develop a community benefits agreement. We would have shifted into implementation of those agreements. Next slide, please. So for timing, we are planning to publish this draft implementation plan this fall, probably around mid-October, but the timing is still under discussion. We are going to solicit feedback online through a digital feedback form through early 2025. We know there are a lot of competing needs for people to review, so we want to give a pretty long review period on this. And then we will compile the comments, update the guidelines, and publish a final version in late 25. Next slide, please. So we're going to reach out in a lot of different ways about the availability of the plan. Coming here is one way to let people know that this is coming. We'll be posting it on our project website. We will send an e-blast. We've got a pretty extensive e-blast email list that will let know about the availability. We will reach out to the county boards of supervisors. We will have an e-blast focused on our EJ communities. In addition to our overall e-blast, we have an EJ-focused e-blast system that we will use, and we will also have phone calls to EJ community members. We will do focused tribal outreach. We will have a hood-focused outreach program that we're going to be using postcards to try to reach people individually. And we have hard copy flyers that we will post in English, Spanish, and Chinese on bulletin boards throughout the Delta. Next slide. We're going to shift now to talk about permit updates overall. So we have a lot of things sort of going on right now that are just making progress, but there's not a lot to report. So just general updates. California Endangered Species Act, we are working with DFW. They are working on an incidental take permit that we are expecting to be complete in fall of this year. We are also working with NMFS and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Endangered Species Act compliance, and we're expecting biological opinions for operations and construction late 24, early 25. For water rights, we are in the process of getting the change in point of diversion hearing moving. It is currently anticipated to start in early 2025, and there are a number of pre-hearing processes going on right now in terms of including pre-hearing conferences and deadlines for information. The next pre-hearing conference is on October 17th. And then for Delta Plan consistency, we are working to submit a certification of consistency on the 2024 through 26 proposed geotechnical activities. And we're also working on a certification of consistency for DCP implementation. Next slide, please. So I wanted to talk about this certification of consistency that we are working to submit very soon. So this is in compliance with the ruling that we received on June 20th of 2024. And because the geotechnical activities only concern data collection, we believe that it is completely independent from the Delta Conveyance Project itself. We've conducted early consultation to talk about this with the DSC staff before we submit this certification. Next slide, please. So we're considering these activities to generate information to refine the project feature layouts and configurations and to develop design and engineering criteria for the Delta Conveyance Project facilities. The information will also support applications and requests to other agencies for permits, authorizations, or conditional approvals. One such authorization would be for a future certification of consistency with the Delta Plan for the construction, operations, and maintenance of the Delta Conveyance Project. So geotechnical information collected from these 24 through 26 activities will help maintain the overall program design schedule, which is very important for the overall project and the amount of money spent overall on this project. Next slide, please. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's included. So this sort of shows how we're sort of looking at a subset of the activities. So the EIR describes field investigations, and within the field investigations, there is a smaller subset that is geotechnical investigations. And within that subset, there is a smaller subset that is pre-construction investigations to support design planning and permitting. And then there is an even smaller subset that's what we're looking at for the 24 through 26 geotechnical activities. It does not include any work on levees, overwater activities that involve trenching or permanent facilities. Next slide. So it does include borings with water quality testing and cone penetration tests. These are the same types of tests that we've been doing for the past couple of years, but the locations are narrowed in on the facilities that we are proposing to have as part of the Delta Conveyance Project. Our earlier geotechnical activities were more broadly focused. So if you look on this slide, it shows a couple of pictures of the activities. So on the right side is a boring machine. So that's what the boring machines look like when they are out in the Delta creating a soil boring. On the left side, it's a trailer that is a cone penetration test. So that includes the machine that pushes the penetration cone into the ground as well as the equipment that monitors that penetration. And the work is going to be in Sacramento, San Joaquin, Contra Costa, and Alameda counties, generally along the alignment for the Bethany alignment of the Delta Conveyance Project. Next slide, please. So we are planning to post the draft of the certification tomorrow for a 10-day public review, and then we will receive comments, consider those comments, and submit this to the Delta Stewardship Council. This is not the same as the certification for the Delta Conveyance Project. The schedule for that remains unchanged from what we've discussed before, so we're looking to that to submit in mid to late 2025. So that brings me to the end. If we want to go to the last slide, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. Does anyone have any questions for Carrie? Oh, Maria?
Yeah, I just want to have clarification on the programs, economic development programs and all that. How do you define the areas where, is it on the basis of a needs assessment or what areas would have that? Or it's one area for all of it?
So I think that is something we're still open to considering. I think that generally we want to focus on areas that are in or near where construction activities would occur. But I think we're open to the idea that, you know, for example, there were some programs suggested during scoping that were like education programs, and those don't necessarily need to be confined to the areas immediately around a construction area. So I think we're open to some creative thought on that.
Sure. And then one more. It's on the basis of some kind of an application process, right, also?
Yes.
Okay. And my last question was, so when you talked about how separate they are, it's what you talked about is for the geotech, not for the interpreter.
For the certification of consistency, what we're looking at is certifying just geotechnical activities for 24 through 26. Okay. So it's a pretty small suite of activities, and just for the period sort of after certification through 2026.
Sure. And then why do you need water quality after the borings?
It's something that helps provide information to the designers to look at the water quality and the groundwater as they move down.
Sure.
It provides a series of information both about the water quality and also about geological constituents.
I see, because that water is separate from the water that is going to run.
Correct.
That's why I asked.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you. All
right. Councilmember Zingali has his hand up.
Hi, Carrie.
Good afternoon.
Have you guys made any stab at a range or an estimate on the scale of the community benefits plan?
So the construction cost estimate that we released in May has $200 million for the community benefits program.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay. And sorry. And Councilmember Burgess, making notes here.
Hello, Carrie. Okay. So the community benefit agreement, that's an agreement between who and who?
It could be between any local entity, an NGO, a local government organization, really whoever might be interested. So we've been reaching out to a number of entities and trying to work through this. The benefit of having a community benefits agreement is it does allow us to engage much more closely and provide technical support. So an entity can really take advantage of some of our technical resources to help develop projects that would fit to be part of the process. Then they don't need to apply for grants. We create those agreements in advance. So they're already sort of understanding the benefits that they would receive.
So if someone isn't a part of the agreement, are they eligible for funding?
Yep, the grant program, they could still submit under the grant program, and we will still work to provide technical support. It's just not, I'd say, as sort of extensive. You know, when we're the community benefit agreement that we've been working on so far, the agreements, we really are able to have our technical people dive in and help in pretty extensive ways, and that's not necessarily going to be the case as part of a grant application.
So Councilmember Zingali asked how much that dollar amount was, and you said $200 million, correct?
Yes.
Did that community benefit increase in proportion to the increase to the cost of the project?
So we developed that as part of this cost estimate. The past cost estimate didn't have a community benefits program specifically line item. So this is just specific to this estimate.
Perfect. Okay. So then you had an example of a parking lot. I think you said a ride share. Mm-hmm. So I just want to clarify my understanding of what you're saying. It's basically that would be like a staging area or something like that for the project. And then when you're done with construction, you would be able to give that to the community if they wanted it.
It's an example. I will say for integrated benefits, we spent some time during our earlier community benefit program meetings trying to generate ideas and, you know, things like, we're going to have this area where we're temporarily disturbing it, and then, you know, we're not, it's not going to be a permanent area. We could do things like turn it into a park or a baseball field or do other stuff with it. And the answer was generally, you know, we really would prefer you to return it to the kind of use it was beforehand. We don't really want it to, we don't really want any of the leave behind type of activities to take up more space,
right,
to take up more land. So I would say generally we haven't gotten as much interest as part of the community benefits program in those kinds of things where it's like a footprint.
Yeah.
The park and ride is an example.
Yeah, no, yeah, and I get it.
But it's just what people might like.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, well, so you have this asset that you would like to give, but how long? So if there's a bucket of money that's $200 million and you've got these assets that have, say, this much value, are you going to hold on to it to the very end to see if somebody will take it, or are you going to?
No, I think that the idea is that we would work with the entity that might, I mean, because we will not be able to manage it indefinitely.
Right.
So we would work with probably the local government entity if they want it. We would have some kind of agreement early on for them to take over that facility afterwards, and if they don't, we'll remove it and return it. So we're not we're not expecting or counting on it. It's just if it's wanted, then we can.
And I see from your timeline that the grant distribution would pretty much start when the construction begins.
Yes.
And so what is the timeline of construction anticipated?
We're looking – the current schedule that we have would start in 2029.
And then would end?
It would end in 2042.
So 13 years?
Yes.
So 13 years, and I've made this point to you before, when we started talking about community benefits, that was before COVID, and things have changed so much, whether it's, you know, culturally or technology-wise or whatever. So some of the things that maybe you've identified as a benefit could change over that period of time. And I just want to make sure that there is that flexibility to be able to meet those needs. Have you considered that there may be new types of anticipated harms that we just didn't expect and that you would need to account for?
So I don't think that we're trying to tie the community benefits projects directly to the kind of effects of the program. I think that we're really looking to the communities to say, here's what would help us, and we're not trying to say, like, we need you to tie this to a specific impact. So I don't think that that would directly provide that kind of limitation. And if there are unanticipated impacts, like we didn't analyze something under CEQA, we do have an ombudsperson program where the public could contact the ombudsperson and work through that process with them.
Okay. So then I'm going to change over to kind of the timeline that you talked about. You said you'd be pursuing the change in point of diversion. I know that it's been communicated that there's a recommendation that be done before it comes before us for consistency. Is that being timed properly so that would meet those expectations?
So our current plan is that we will wait till the hearing is over, because we do think that there is a lot that comes out of the hearing that would be part of our record.
Okay.
But we are not planning to wait for the final determination because we have schedule constraints. So we're sort of trying to walk that line down the middle.
Okay. And then I see the timeline for the geotech is tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yes.
So that's interesting. And then we did talk about the cost analysis before, and I just find it really interesting that recently Los Vaqueros happened. A well-intended project is considered no longer viable in light of changing conditions, whether it's the conservation and all of that, or the tightening of regulatory and permitting restrictions, and the significant cost increases. Do you think this is indicative of other things?
I think that those are things that you just mentioned that we are really aware of. I think that one of the things, Graham Bradner, who is the executive director of the DC, is the executive director, but was here at the last meeting. He was talking about the efforts that the DCA is undergoing to manage costs and also to look for innovative ideas for ways to reduce the costs as part of the construction. So I think we're pretty early in our planning process, and we're very aware of trying to manage those issues.
Thank you very much.
All right. Are there any other questions for Carrie? Not seeing any from the members. We will go to public comments.
There are no public comments, Madam Chair.
All righty. Thank you, Carrie, for being here. Appreciate your update.
Thank you for having me.
And our final agenda item for today is in preparation for the next council meeting, which will take place on October 24th at the CNRA building in Sacramento. And we will post our meeting notice with further information and updates. And with that, we will conclude our meeting. Thank you guys for all your work on the offsite as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you.